brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Lots of stuff to get to. Yes, lots of things, lots to do, lots to talk about. The issues abound. Yes, we're going to be talking about the assaults on public sector workers, those pension millionaires. Boy, they really know how to coin a term, don't they? You know, those millionaire pension people. Those people. You know, anytime the wealth class tells me that they're concerned about the working people, protect your wallets. Grab for the wallet. Make sure you're not being robbed. Because, well, you are. We'll talk about that. Also, in the second hour, we're going to talk about the free trade myths that they keep ramming down our throat. Free trade's good for us! It's good for business! Yeah, it's good for business, but is it good for you? Is it good for me? And I would even argue that I don't even know that it's good for business, at least American business. So we'll talk about that. Also, in the second hour, we'll talk with Josh Adelson, Salon reporter, about his piece on fake news on Fox. And really, the shills that they are going after the safety of workers and public safety as a whole. You know, saying the government's, while they're trying to make people healthy. And in the third hour, with all of the reports of all of these mass shootings, all of these mass killings, is it something about us? Is it something in the water? Are we doing something different? Are their brains different? What is it that's causing all of this? We'll have a little discussion about that. Also, your questions, your comments, your thoughts, whatever's on your mind this great day. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Interesting day today in history. One of those moments in history that you look back on and you go, what would things have been different had this not happened? You know, we all go back through our lives and go, you know, had I not done this, you know, something else would have happened. And would that have been good? Would that have been bad? Those are questions open for debate. But today, March 31st, back in the year 1968, I was an entire year old. No, I wasn't quite a year old yet. But I was 10 months old. Lyndon Baines Johnson said that I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party as your president. He said, we have won when all our people were united. What we have won when all people were united must not be lost in partisanship. He said, I have concluded that I should not permit the presidency to become involved in partisan decisions. Johnson acknowledged that there was division in the American House, and he withdrew his name from the national spotlight in the name of unity. He said the ultimate strength of our country was our unity. And he said, you know, and it's one of those moments where you go back and you look at it in history and you look at the time that was and you look at the person and you go, he said, you know, he gave this speech about, you know, I'm not going to do this. We need to bring people back together. We've got people and soldiers in harm's way and all of this stuff and, you know, changing and all of that. And he said, you know, to use the FDR line, of those to whom much is given, much is asked. And, you know, he went off on this. I look to this time in history, and this is one of those things that you look back on and you go, wow, in hindsight, the wealth class of this country was already really heavily behind the scenes, pushing for division, pushing to really divide the country into factions. And, you know, all of these decisions that were going on, the war for one, the war on poverty was huge. And that, I think, really sprung the wealth class into, uh-oh, we're in favor of war. Yeah, because we're making money off it. But that war on poverty thing, not so much. And, you know, LBJ said in his 37 years of public service, he had put national unity ahead of everything else. Because as he said, he was, how did he put it? He was an American first, or a free man, an American, a public citizen, a public servant, and a member of my party. And in that order, always and only, was his sentiment. And in his 37 years of public service, he said he had put the national unity ahead of everything else. because it was as true now as it has ever been that a house divided against itself by the spirit of faction, of party, of region, of religion, of race, is a house that cannot stand. And I immediately thought of our political structure right now, how we see the party of the wealth class really, really going after and attempting to destroy what years and generations of workers built for their children and their grandchildren. You know, you go back to Eisenhower, and, you know, labor was one of those things that both parties, because they had members in both parties, as they still do, but members of both parties, you know, that's a decided issue. We believe in good working conditions and safe working conditions and in workers having a right to a voice. We don't want to go back to the way things were before and during the Depression. We don't want to go back to the Middle Ages, if you will. We want to make sure that we grow on a higher plane and with better conditions for everybody. That's now changed, completely changed, to where what we have is we have a government that is completely divided. And it's not that the Democrats have, to be honest, and, you know, I'm one of the guys who say, you know, the Democrats have gone way too far to the right. With Clinton, you know, they've taken that rightward, pro-corporate stance. We're going after the money because, look, in order to get elected, they need the money and lots of it. So you've got to go and you've got to say, hey, we need that corporate cash. So I look at this report put out by the people over at Politics PA. They point out that it's the ninth straight month that the Washington Post has rated our governor one of the most vulnerable governors in the 2014 midterm election. And you go, why is that? You know, why is it that you've got this governor as, you know, 9 months in a row, the most vulnerable guy in the state, an incumbent? Why is it that you've got him 9 months in a row being the guy who's probably going to lose? And I would argue it's because of the divisiveness. It's because Pennsylvania isn't as far to the right politically yet. I would argue that Wisconsin and Ohio, population-wise, are nowhere as far to the radical right as their political leadership. But what you've got is, here in Pennsylvania, we've got a Republican Party that's split in half. So what you've got is you've got a state that politically is divided between Democrats and Republicans, and a Republican Party that's divided on really some very, very divisive stuff. And as I thought today about the LBJ decision not to run for re-election based on, you know what, we need to have some unity back. We need to start over, kind of. I thought of Corbett. Maybe you ought to be saying, you know what, I'm going to step away. And some of these radical Republicans who have brought this outside Wall Street Koch brother agenda here to Pennsylvania, maybe they need to start stepping back for the good of the Commonwealth to say, you know what, we're not going to allow our state, our country, to devolve into factions and destruction. Sadly, that's not what's going to happen, and that's not going to be the reality. The reality is we've got a governor who we're going to go for re-election, and we're going to use whoever we can. And George sent me this story from Pittsburgh that the governor evidently had visited this ARC center, this ARC of Northeastern Pennsylvania center on Tuesday. And I guess this is one of these places that, you know, helps the people who are some of the most vulnerable in the state, have some mental health issues that they're dealing with, and some real struggles that they're dealing with. And the whole push here is to trying to get people off of this waiting list. It's a home, you know, it's a home for disabled and a community-based services stuff that are trying to get people off of this waiting list to get services. And, you know, people with intellectual disabilities. And, you know, the governor's out there saying, well, what we need to do is, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I guess in this last budget, They've allocated a little bit of money to help, I guess, about 1,100 people. That will help about 1,100 people get off the list. Now, forget the 4,000 that will be left, but it'll help a few more. So he was at this place, trying to make the pitch that, well, we're going to change things. We're going to, well, look, we're helping these 1,100 people. Good PR, good picture with people that he's really stepped on and kicked between the eyes the last 3 years. And, I saw a number of stories on it, and they were all feel-good stories. Oh, look how wonderful. Look how nice. Oh, he's brought some money back. Never mind that in the budget prior, you're talking about a 10% cut to a group like this ARC. And, the increase that they're getting is never going to make up what they lost. Never mind that. And what's really sickening to me is that for all of the rhetoric that came out of this PR, this public relations stunt, I didn't see any questions about how much did you cut. When you kick 70,000 people off of the general assistance budget, what happened to those people? When you slashed health and human services funding for the last 3 years, what happened to those people? And it looked like from the reports that I saw, one of the only people that asked anything was someone who asked about the extraction tax, who asked about a severance tax, who said, hey, look, Texas has a tax. They have a franchise tax on corporations. They've raised tons of money. They've raised, I think the report was $3.4 billion over the same period that where we got, I think it was a couple hundred million. Is the number that they threw at. And you go, wouldn't it be, and the guy asked this simple question, wouldn't it be better to raise that tax so we could afford to cover those extra 4,000 people? And the way I read the reporting of it is the guy was just chastised for, how dare you and your yellow journalism, and how dare you ask questions like this? And it just kind of made me stop and think, you go, there's something seriously wrong with our media structure when the only things that you really see are like these fluff pieces. It's one of those things that just leaves me with that taste in my mouth that goes, we really need to have alternative voices who are going to ask those questions, because that's how we keep the Corbetts or the Obamas or anybody. That's how we keep them on the straight and narrow. And if they don't have to answer those questions, if they don't have to stand before we the people, and they don't have to say what they're doing or what they're going to do, then how do we know who to pull the lever for? And then is the lever just more about partisanship and my team than it is about good governance and the future of the country for my children? I mean, that's kind of where I'm at with this. It kind of makes you wonder. But we're going to talk a little bit more about the divisiveness. We're going to talk about the assault on workers. So much more. I'd love to hear from you. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
It's a beautiful day because working people are standing together. It's a beautiful day because working people are on the move together. See, we're taking a message across the country. Working people are taking action for a better life.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka speaking on the Philadelphia stop of the Give America a Raise bus tour. The bus rolls into Milwaukee today with support from Wisconsin Jobs Now, Wisconsin Citizen Action, the state AFL-CIO, and others. Trumka says there's a nationwide struggle underway to raise wages.
There's a new national debate going on right now. It's going on all across this country. It's about raising wages for hardworking people. It's about getting people a fair shake and justice and real benefits on the job. And while our leaders may be a little tone deaf to it, the working people out there are talking about raising their wages every single day, right?
Yes.
According to MIT's Living Wage Calculator, a living wage in Milwaukee is $19,717. If a single full-time worker made $10.10 an hour, that annual wage would be $21,008. The University of Wisconsin's Center on Wisconsin Strategy says that boosting the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour would give more than 500,000 Wisconsin workers raises and would generate 3,800 jobs. For the fifth straight year, the United Auto Workers Union has added new members. The UAW report filed with the U.S. Department of Labor reported a net gain of nearly 9,000 members in 2013. Job creation under UAW collective bargaining agreements at the Detroit Three automakers since 2008, plus successful organizing in places like New York University, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Arlington, Texas, and Louisville, Kentucky, and also at casinos in Ohio and Las Vegas, all contributed to the UAW's five straight years of membership growth. UAW contracts have brought production of the Ford Fusion and medium-duty trucks from Mexico back to Michigan, and transit commercial van production back to Kansas City from Europe. UAW says there are thousands more workers who are still bargaining first contracts or who are represented by the union but have yet to sign union cards. When those are included, UAW membership is over 400,000. Tuesday in Wisconsin, 13 communities will vote on resolutions calling for a constitutional amendment to overturn the U.S. Supreme Court Citizens United decision, allowing unlimited corporate money in politics. George Penn is with Move to Amend.
This movement is needed so that we can get our democracy. Those of us of all stripes, conservative, independent, and liberals, realize that our country's politics has been co-opted by money. Ultimately, this was triggered by a decision by the Supreme Court called Citizens United that said you can't really limit money put into politics. And from that came this movement. We want to get a constitutional amendment that basically said two things. One, a corporation is not a person. And two, money is not speech.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Scott Right Wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
I work for the state now, helping kids with disabilities. I love the work, hate the rules, for bosses than you would believe. We had layoffs again this morning. I got my children now that I can see. Parents are angry, how can I blame them? They end up blaming me. When did I become a problem? How did folk become all mine? The governor says they're tightening their belt. The only one that's tightening is mine.
Yeah, I got to ask that question. When did you become the problem, public sector workers? Well, I guess about 3 years ago, right? Because it was February when Scott Walker began his assault on public sector workers, and it was today, 3 years ago on this very day, that Governor John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, signed into law the assault that became SB 5, the assault on collective bargaining on workers in Ohio, which fortunately those workers had the ability to fight. And well, if you remember, Kasich said, "You need to get on the bus or we're going to run you over." Well, it looks like that bus backed over him. And hopefully this November, the bus not only runs him over, but runs him out of the state. Anyway, here to talk about what's going on here in Pennsylvania and some new phrases we're probably going to be hearing. I've asked David Filman, executive director of Ask Me Council 13, to come talk with us. Dave, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks a lot, and that's an anniversary I hope I can forget someday.
No, I'm with you. But, you know, that's one of those positives because, you know, when we here at the program were in Ohio during that election period where they went back and you know, gave Kasich a boot in the behind.
Yeah, that was an incredible effort on that referendum, and it came out, you know, obviously the winner. Lots and lots of work that went into that, and they're still around. You know, Kasich has been very backpedaling a lot of this stuff lately, but it's still something that sticks in our mind.
You know, 3 years ago, we were in Wisconsin sleeping on the floor of the Capitol. We were in Ohio. We covered the stuff in Michigan and all across the country as these right-wing attacks, the Koch brother moneyed attacks, went on in other states. And all the while, we're saying, folks, the reason we're in Wisconsin or Ohio or Michigan or Missouri or any of these places is because it's coming here to Pennsylvania, and now we see really that some of the insanity that had gone on in those states right here.
Yeah, we are. And, you know, unfortunately, the first ones out of the box are the public employees. They're vilifying all of them. for just being working for the either state government or local government or school district or whatever. And it's obviously totally uncalled for. We've got our plate full in Pennsylvania when we're fighting these, if it's either the paycheck deception piece or some of the right to work stuff that keeps rumbling around out there. We are prepared not only in the public sector, but our brothers in the private sector are fully behind us on a lot of these, because if it's not us tomorrow, it's going to them tomorrow.
Yeah, everyone's in the Shark Tank. It's just one's the flavor of the month. And I got to tell you, on the weekends, I went back to driving a truck just to kind of stay in it. And I'll tell you, this winter, I have never been more grateful for the guys driving the salt shakers. Probably a lot of your members out there on some of the worst days possible, keeping the roads safe and open.
Absolutely. PennDOT's one of our largest agencies. Most of our thousands of members. We have men and women driving those trucks. And let me tell you, as I've said before in your show, Rick, Pennsylvania has the most public or state roads than New England, New York, New Jersey combined, but we only have one toll road, and that's the Turnpike. So the rest of those roads that everybody drives on is all part of your taxes in the state of Pennsylvania. And I happened to be in Maryland about a month and a half ago when they had snow. And Maryland and Washington, D.C., they don't deal with it like we do in Pennsylvania. And the roads were a mess. But I can tell you, if it's either Interstate 80, 95, you name it, those roads are really, really good. And our members do really hard work doing that. They're away from their families, weekends, holidays, you name it. When the snows come down, they're out there working.
I drive every Sunday as just kind of a hobby, just to kind of stay in it. And it just seemed like every Sunday was a horrible kind of snowstorm. And I would tweet out or I would, put on Facebook thanking them for being out there and thanks for the hard work and dedication. And then in a sarcastic kind of facetious, snide way, say, now was a good time to steal their pensions while they're working. And, I mean that in a very facetious way, but the right wing in this state, they see it as an opportunity.
Yeah, and there was a piece that was put out just 2 weeks ago by a guy by the name of Biggs out of the American Enterprise Institute.
Yep.
Obviously a very right-wing think tank. He took on how it was entitled How to Become a Public Pension Millionaire. And really, he just took on the whole issue of public pensions in a wrong light. His figures were tilted towards his story. For instance, he just talked about retirees that had retired within the last couple of years. Now, those are folks that obviously have a higher salary. And also, there were people that had so many years of service that they worked. So their pensions would have been higher because of their salary and everything else. When we calculate it, and I'm saying not only AFSCME, but the labor movement in general, we look at the entire package of folks that have been working 30, 35 years of service, folks that have been there for a long period of time before when the pensions were lower. So we're looking at the whole aggregate when it comes to that the whole pension piece. Also, as you may or may not know, Rick, in Pennsylvania, both the public school pension and the state pension doesn't have a cost of living adjustment. The pensioners haven't had a cost of living adjustment in 12 years. And he put that into his calculation, that this is how you make so much money working a public pension. And finally, he just pulled out the state pensions. State employees, just by the nature of the work, are paid higher mostly than the municipal employees. It's not always the case, but primarily a majority of it is that way. Whereas we take the aggregate of all of the pensions that public employees have, either in the cities or the boroughs, the townships, and the state, and put that together. So when we float around these $24,000 pensions, that is an accurate piece, and it's even lower if you do bring in the municipalities. But Mr. Biggs and his calculations just wanted to zero in on the folks that retired currently. And also, as you know, we passed what's called Act 120 a couple of years ago. Well, that dropped the pensions for people in the future. So actually, his calculation is going to start going the other way, because as employees, we have 16,000 now that are on state employees who are new under Act 120. And when they retire 10 years beyond, and it's now coming down, it's 7 years beyond, their pensions are going to be lesser than what the current employees have. So we are working in that way to reduce the cost of pensions. But, you know, the whole thing, Rick, this wasn't conversation 30, 40, 50 years ago, because everybody was enjoying a defined benefit program, a pension. And that was a calculation, a percentage of their salary times their years of service. Now we've got statistics that 36% of workers have less than $1,000 in savings because they're all into the 401ks,
yep.
And 60% have less than $25,000. So, you know, we're really starting to flick things around here where folks are not enjoying the rewards of working all those years of their lives. And when you have folks that have that little money in their 401ks, it's going to be a tax on the welfare system.
Yeah, and what we're talking about is a major pension crisis in the very near future because of people who don't have it. And that's the question that we should, I think, be talking about, and not something I heard or saw in the American Enterprise Institute's piece by Mr. Biggs. And I got to be honest, I found his use of public sector millionaires. I found it very interesting that, you know, a group that's the wealth class apologists, that they're out there trying to use class warfare against people who are making $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year.
Yeah, and I mean, are there millionaires out there? Well, I think the one that comes to mind in Pennsylvania was Joe Paterno. I mean, here this guy had 50 years of service. Yes, he was paid a lot, but that's the nature of that game as football coaches in the collegiate area.
That's not the guy who kept my road open on Sundays.
That's exactly right, Rick. Those are such not the norm at all, but those are the kind of statistics they pull out. Then you throw in the chancellors from the PASHI system. You throw in some of the psychologists that work in some of the mental institutions. Now you're starting to kick that number up there, and yes, there are some significant high numbers. That's not what my members make, or the guy that's gal that's driving that salt shaker behind you.
But it sure makes for a nice talking point. Public sector millionaires, see what your tax dollars pay. A guy living on the beach.
I don't know anybody like that. In fact, the statistic is 95% of the public sector employees at ASRS. 95% of them stay in the state of Pennsylvania. They don't even move to the beaches or anything like that. They stay right here and live right here in Pennsylvania, use their pension money to buy the stuff from the deli down the street, the dry cleaner up the street. You know, that money stays right here, and that's the other advantage of these defined benefits that Mr. Biggs doesn't talk about. We invest that money right back here in Pennsylvania. It doesn't go to the 401ks on Wall Street or Connecticut or wherever those things are. It stays right here, and it's regrown right back into the state. So those are the kinds of things that don't get talked about. And again, when you look at the figures, when you pull out just the state employees, when you pull out the recently retired, when you throw in the cost of living increases that don't exist in Pennsylvania, and you take away the municipal pensions, now the numbers go up a little bit. But hardly millionaires do we have out there.
No, nobody's gambling on Wall Street with those pensions. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Dave Feldman, Executive Director of Ask Me Council 13. You know, Dave, one of the things that you hit on with the Wall Street or out of town or all that stuff is, to me, this talk of crisis, all of this talk of changing the public sector pensions seems to me to be more of a scheme, an ideological scheme to privatize and, of course, profitize. And I point to, and it's interesting that Biggs from the American Enterprise Institute's the face of this, because I remember him testifying in a hearing here in Pennsylvania where he explicitly said that defined contribution plans are more expensive than defined benefit plans, but that they should do it because he believes it's the right thing to do.
I didn't know that. That's information I never knew. But you're right. I mean, that is out there, and we even hear it from the legislators. The legislators say, yeah, we know, changing over to the DC plan is going to be costly. Yeah, we know, things are going to be a little bit more expensive, and there's going to be a couple of tiers, and there's more administrative costs involved, but we've got to do it because everybody else is doing it. Well, it's just, you know, really the nature of the beast, again. We've got the issue of not being able to change the benefits for current employees under the constitutional provisions of the state constitution. So we're, if someone is going to try, and the talk is out there, Rick, we know it because, you know, Governor Corbett put it in his address, his State of the State address, that he wants to look at it. There's not one plan out there. There's a variety of ideas. But nothing is really sticking to the wall right now. They're just throwing things out there and trying to see it. I have to be convinced that the numbers work. What we did in Act 120 was put everything in place that everybody wanted, and now we're looking at it again.
Have you given it, has there been sufficient time to look at the results of what Act 120 aimed to do? I mean, it seems to me it was just a couple of years ago that, and I don't know that in that short period of time that you're really going to be able to gauge whether whether, you know, positive or negative, that it's going to work.
Well, and that's you're absolutely right. Because, like I said, there's 16,000 right now in CSRS, and I think there's actually 25,000 to 30,000 in PCRS. Those folks are contributing higher rates of contributions for a lesser benefit, so we are putting knocking down that unfunded liability. And, as I've said before in your show, we're the only state in the nation that has a share risk or shared sacrifice provision. If the investments don't work out, and, oh, by the way, it was 13% the returns in 2013 for CSRS. If they didn't meet their expectations, the new employees would have to contribute up to 1% more into it. So they've got so much more skin in the game. But that's the idea, is we're buying down that unfunded liability. You go to the 401K, the defined comp, that stops. We're not paying it down anymore. Some of them say it out of the side of their mouth, but they know it's not going to fix it.
And you use the word unfunded liability, and I got to ask why we have this unfunded liability.
Well, the unfunded liability is if everybody decides to retire tomorrow, every school teacher, every school employee, every state employee, there would be a bill come due. It's like, you know, when you take a look at your mortgage of your house and you look at if it's a possibly $100,000, $200,000, you say, holy mackerel, how can I afford that? But the problem is we've got that unfunded liability because 10 years in a row we weren't paying what we were supposed to, and 2 years we paid zero, and that's the employer. The employees were contributing the whole time, and now they keep talking about these collars, which the collars are not even paying exactly what it's supposed to be again. So we're on this road, path down the road where we're not paying what we're supposed to. That's how we got in the mess in the first place.
That's why I asked that question, because, you know, I understand that the thing that got us into this mess is over a decade of not making the proper contributions. We've got a governor who said, well, we're not going to raise taxes, but we're going to screw the system up even further in the future by not making the contributions we're supposed to be making now. And, oh, let's not forget that massive collapse that happened in 2008, brought to us by the former President George W. Bush.
Exactly. And if you keep in mind, when people talk about the benefits, when we raised the benefits in 2001, that was when it was 130% funded. We had more money that we knew what to do with. If we look back now and say we shouldn't have done that, yeah. But that's what Act 120 does, moves it all back to where it was before.
Last question I've got for you. You know, in talking about pensions for public sector workers, and I know your job is to defend those, and that shouldn't we be talking about as a society making sure that all working people have some retirement security? And isn't this a good opportunity to say, look, our members are making, you know, $18,000, $20,000 in pension, not a huge amount, but instead of taking it from them, shouldn't we be talking about making sure that everyone has that?
It's funny you should say that. I was just in a meeting last week in Washington, D.C. President Saunders, our international president, appointed me chairman of the committee to do exactly that, to look at some sort of retirement security for everybody. California's dabbling in it. They're looking to put some 401Ks or IRAs out for private sector and small business employees that don't have an opportunity to do this. Connecticut, I believe, is looking into a plan also. And there was some talk from Senator Harkin to expand Social Security so some folks could get in it or get some benefits out of it that they don't just have right now. Because when I read those numbers about people only have $1,000 in their 401K, they're not going to make it. And we have to. It's not let's take something away from Rick Smith. Let's make sure everybody has a comfortable retirement.
And that's to me, if we're not going to expand Social Security, which I think it's idiotic to even considering the idea of change CPI or any reduction to Social Security, I think we should be expanding it. But beyond that, opening up, you know, maybe PCRS and CSRS, or as you've pointed out, to other types of opportunities for working people to get something that they may not be getting elsewhere.
It'll be great because then we can pool that money together. They get a better return than if they had it on their own nest egg.
I'm looking forward to hearing what you guys come up with, Dave. I appreciate you taking time for us. Always great having you on the program.
Thanks for the opportunity, my friend.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
After all, something as simple as rock and roll would save us all. Now who'd have thought that after all, it was rock and roll.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
There are a lot of folks named Bill Jones, but likely only one kept classified photographs secret for more than 40 years. Bill Jones of Stark County, Indiana, was a military photographer, and though he gained some fame from it, it was not what he wanted to do. Jones had a passion for airplanes and wanted to fly them. He took pilot training at Bearfield in 1944, but his rheumatic fever as a child kept his weight too low to ever become an Air Force pilot. Still, Jones's desire to fly is what led him to his moment in history. He went on to spend 6 months in aerial photography in B-17 aircraft. And that was the beginning of a trail that would take him and his cameras to some of the most fascinating scenes in the world's history. Join us again next time for Jones's most famous photographs. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Ah, progress. In the 2012 elections, Republicans cast themselves as budget balancers by promising to whack welfare programs for the poor, snarling that such people are takers and moochers. Such vindictive sourness didn't play too well with voters, and Republicans now seem to have learned their lesson. Oh, they're still going after food stamps, school lunches, etc., with a vengeance, but this time with a gentle, even loving tone. The GOP's official message massagers now have their members saying that they want to, quote, help the poor by eliminating those programs, referring to them as soulless giveaways that sap their initiative and tether them to the cold, uncaring hand of government. The message is, we're doing this for the poor people's own good. Their chief budgeteer, Representative Paul Ryan, trotted out this theme at a recent right-wing rally, condemning school lunches as unloving Obama fare, plopped on plates by unsmiling cafeteria personnel. What they're offering people is a full stomach and an empty soul, he oozed. If that doesn't make you gag, try another subsidized lunch program that tender-hearted GOP budget whackers never mention, much less demand that it be eliminated. It's the tax subsidy for corporate meals, drinks, and entertainment. Multimillionaire CEOs can go whining and dining on your and my dime, writing off their high-dollar lunches, cocktails, dinners, and club hopping as a business expense. And expensive it is for us taxpayers. This subsidy adds up to more than $12 billion a year. And that doesn't count the human cost of executive initiative that is sapped by this giveaway, and the lack of love a CEO feels from being dependent on unsmiling taxpayers. This is Jim Hightower saying, we ought to be subsidizing healthy meals for poor people, especially school kids, but not a dime for fat cat CEOs dining out at Chez Gourmand.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy, The Rick Smith Show.
Right now, give it to us now. We want all of it. We want all of your retirement, all of your savings. Give it to us now. In fact, you should work for free. You know, it's one of the things I love. You know, and I'm surprised that Dave didn't remember Mr. Biggs's comment at the hearing on pensions. I think it was either last summer or the summer before, because this whole thing's been going on for quite some time. You know, it's one of those things where you go, hey, you know, it's kind of getting out of hand, this insanity. But It's really about ideology. It's about blind faith belief. And when Biggs was testifying, the American Enterprise Institute guy, he said, look, it's going to be more costly to go to the defined contribution. It's going to be more costly to go to switch over to the 401k than it would be to fix the defined benefits. But over the long haul, it's the right thing to do. And their mentality is, you know, hey, it's the right thing because this is what our view of society, what our view of the world is all about. This whole idea that the risk should be shouldered by those least able to shoulder it. And the more important part of this, it's like, you know, the fox, you know, separating the sheep from the herd. You get one off, you can pluck one off at a time. If they're all in a big group, a little more difficult, which is why the people who tell us that you're an individual, they're the ones who are screwing you and me. This whole idea that, oh, you can make your own deal, you can do your own investing. Yeah. You know, I remember before the Bush collapse. Let's pine back. Let's remember those days. I remember, you know, I was driving a truck for a living, and I had a bunch of friends who were playing the Wall Street gambling game. They had their whatever account. You know, there's a bunch of them at advertise on TV that they'll make trades for you for $8 or $10 or whatever it is. And you could get in and out real easy. And it's just like any gambling. Once they get you hooked, man, it's your life. And I remember guys telling me, oh, I made, you know, $800 today on this trade, and I made $50 on this trade, and, oh, I'm doing great, my trades are going up, and I'm winning, and I'm winning, and I'm winning. And then all of a sudden, boom, the bottom falls out. And I go, how you doing today? How'd you do today? And then for the next couple of months, hey, how you doing today? They lost just about everything, just about all of it gone. And you go, whoa. I thought you were winning. I thought you. And then they couldn't pay their mortgages. And then they couldn't pay the light bill. And then they couldn't put shoes on the kids' feet. And then came the pay cuts because, oh, the company needs concessions because the economy's hurting. And then you start seeing houses lost, and you start seeing all of this stuff going on. You're going, but I thought you were winning. And then you look back, you go, well, what security now do you have? And this is where we are, folks. We're in this situation where they've been telling us for years, oh, you're going to win. Only to have this catastrophe happen that everybody was predicting. I mean, every reasonable economist knew that this was going to happen. And as I said for years, I was on the air for a number of years before the Bush collapse saying, look, the next president, whoever it's going to be, I was figuring March, the bottom would fall out, February, March, because there's always an adjustment after a new president. Wall Street gets a little hanky, but I was expecting the big cliff because I thought the Bush administration would have the ability to keep the economy propped up. I'm no genius. I'm just a guy who pays attention. And as you saw this happen, and then bang, September, it falls out, you go, wow, it must be worse than I even imagined. And it was. And we didn't have a problem with bailing out Wall Street $750 billion. But those working people who are out there driving the salt shakers, keeping our roads open, those guys who are out there patching the roads, those women who are taking care of my grandmother, those women who are men and women who are teaching my kids, somehow, we can't help them. Sorry. You know, times are tough. Got to tighten the belt a little bit. Got to tighten the belt. Right? Got to tighten the belt. Times are tough. We're broke. We don't have any money. Lights are going to be off any minute now. But, boy, we need to bail out Wall Street. There's the sky is not even the limit. 700. Think about this. Remember this. Burn this into the back of your minds. $750 billion. We gave to Wall Street and guaranteed trillions more on two pieces of paper. That's it. Two fingers. Woo-hoo. That's it. Something even Herman Cain could read. Two pages. You want to talk about no strings attached? There it was. If you want to get unemployment because you lost your job through no fault of your own, do you think you can do it in two pages? I guarantee you cannot. If your kids are hungry and you need food stamps, do you think you're going to do it in two pages? Oh, you had better rethink that game. If you need Medicaid because you lost your job and you're now basically indigent, do you think you're going to do it in two pages? Guess again. Because any help that comes to working people comes with lots of loops, lots of string holes, and lots of obstacles and turns and twists and, oh, denials, lots of denials. And then, of course, the looking down the nose and, oh, you're a drug addict, you must be, here's a cup. Before we can help you, before we can let you feed your kids, cup! That's what they're doing across this country. Did they cup Wall Street? Where, honestly, you know, watch every movie about what goes on Wall Street. It's like cocaine heaven. You want to be testing anybody, test the people who are in charge of our economy. I'm not so much worried about the guy smoking pot on the weekends, gardening in his backyard here. I'm worried about the guy who's in charge of our entire economy. Maybe we should be drug testing them. Or morality testing at the minimum. So as I look at this, it leads me to this place, just especially on the pension front, that instead of us talking about how do we steal from these people who've worked their lives dedicated to our service, maybe we should be asking the question, how do we make sure that not only they get it, but you and me and every other working person in this country does too? Because it's not only good for them, it's good for all of us. And I think as Dave Filmon pointed out there, 92, 95% of the people who retire from the state stay in the state. So that money stays, in my local neighborhood, something we've talked about many, many times in this program. Seems like a good idea to me. Kind of does, doesn't it? Seems kind of nice. Kind of smart. Maybe a policy we could, potentially think about. I'd love to know what you think. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Jess Levin. On Fox News' Fox and Friends Sunday, co-host Anna Koyman and Independent Women's Forum Executive Director Sabrina Schaefer pushed several debunked minimum wage myths on the air.
The majority of minimum wage earners are working part-time. The majority are younger workers, 16 to 24, about 50% are. So it's not quite this dire situation where you have the head of households who are not able to care for their families. And there are, when the price of something goes up, people tend to buy less.
So you're saying it's continuing this phony war on women?
Yeah, of course.
In fact, women make up the majority of minimum wage earners and would benefit much more from an increased minimum wage. According to research from the Center for American Progress, women make up 48.3% of the total workforce, yet two-thirds of minimum wage earners are women. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425. The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Also, iTunes and however else you can get the program. We also do the YouTube video. You can watch me in the studio flailing my arms around. I deliberately don't watch myself on the screen because I actually feel kind of silly watching myself going, hey, put your hands down, stupid. Nobody's watching you. Wheel your hands around. So there you go. I got an email during the break. Sent me to this CNN Money article on the minimum wage. And, you know, one of these things that you go, common sense would tell us that we should probably raise the minimum wage because we could use the boost to our economy. You know, just a thought we could actually use. And if you saw Janet Yellen had given a speech, I think it was today, to these community development conference attendees today, where she said, you know, we need to be doing more to stimulate the economy. The Fed hasn't done enough to combat unemployment, according to her. Because, you know, there's the argument, and an accurate argument, that if you had a tight labor force, as we did back during the Clinton years, and I give Greenspan credit on the point that he didn't raise interest rates right away to slow the economy down, let the labor market tighten, and then wages went up. And then Clinton came in, and Clinton and Gingrich with their welfare deform and threw a bunch of people into the workforce, and the bottom fell out of the wage structure. But that's a whole other argument. But Yellen's saying, look, you know, we're not going to do anything yet because they're committed to fighting unemployment. She said this extraordinary commitment is still needed and will be for some time, and that she believes that the view is widely shared with her fellow policymakers. This idea that the scars from the Great Recession are still here, and it's going to take time to dig out of it still. Because remember, and I know it's you know, 5 years ago, I know it was 2008, and I'm 5.5 years ago, and I know it seems like a lifetime ago. But we're talking almost 1 million jobs a month lost. You know, 600,000, 700,000, 800,000, 900,000 jobs month after month after month after month. The economy falling, the bottom of the economy falling out from under us. And, you know, Yellen, you know, gave an example of a worker who had lost two jobs, was homeless, and, you know, now just, you know, serves food samples at a local grocery store just to make ends meet, just to try and stay from being homeless. And it tells you, you know, hey, we got work to do. And you look at this new report by CNN Money that was sent to me that points out, because we hear, what do we hear all the time? That minimum wage workers are just, well, it's just those pimply-faced teenagers. It's granny trying to make some bingo money. You know, it's those kids with their first job. It's not mom and dad competing with the kid because the job market is so bad that there are no more pimply-faced teenagers working at the jobs that you used to think of as low wage. No, it's not that at all. But the CNN report came out with 260,000 people working minimum wage jobs had college degrees. I mean, it's amazing stuff to me. And it's something I think we've got to really stop and think about a little bit. Let's go to the phone lines and see what we got on line one. Hey, how you doing tonight? What's on your mind?
Hello.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
I had to wait for 4 hours today before I got my dinner. I live in a...
All right, I appreciate the call. Thanks so much. You know, you look at this, and it's about looking at these structures that are in place to make sure that people can actually make a living and feed their families. And you look at the numbers that are out there, 260,000 people had college degrees. 260,000 people did what they were told they had to do. Take out loans, go to college, get advanced degrees. And they're working for minimum wage jobs. Now, understand, we are down from the high, which was 327,000 people in 2010, and it's coming down a little bit. But you're talking about 260,000 people in this country who have college degrees working for minimum wage. Now, you look at I throw also into this, the other part that CNN Money points out is the other part of this is 21 states across the country have minimum wages above 7.25. So when you're looking at people who are making $7.25 an hour, the federal minimum wage, 21 states are out of the equation. So the question then becomes is just how bad is it then? You know, how many in those 21 states are making minimum wage? And according to a 2012 NELP report, National Employment Law Project, they point out that some 58% of the jobs created during the Bush collapse, low-wage jobs. The retail sector, food service workers, you know, your basic low-wage service sector economy jobs that are right in that range. These aren't the $20, $30 an hour factory jobs that my grandparents' generation had. These are here, pick up some snot off the floor, and here's minimum wage. Now, according to the census, if you look at the census since 2000, in that decade from 2000 to 2010, median household income dropped by $4,000. So what you saw is you saw your wages going backwards. You saw your wages going down. And I don't know about you, $4,000's an awful lot of money per family. Think about if we had that kind of money to put into the economy and have that stimulating effect of more consumer spending. And one of the examples they gave, and this is why I think the fast food forward movement, the fast food 15 campaign is so important, because it's putting that pressure on going, you know what? We're not taking it anymore. And you're seeing people in the streets, and you're seeing Obama going, because if you remember, it was $9 an hour. We should raise the minimum wage to $9. Now he's out there with the 10-10 people. Last week we talked to the people driving around in the bus, saying we need to raise it to 10-10, and I agree. I like McCord's stance, 10-70. I like Stack's, Mike Stack's stance, $12, index it, so that we don't have to have these fights over and over and over again. I mean, that's the thing that gets me. At some point, don't you go, hey, yeah, we've done this enough. But the article pointed out a woman who worked at Victoria's Secret, and I don't know about you. I've bought things from Victoria's Secret for my wife. Ain't cheap. There's some money to be had there. They pay their employees just above minimum wage, and I guess as the article has pointed out, when they started a campaign for higher pay in the New York City store, what ended up happening is they gave people a raise about $1 or $2 a piece, and I'm telling you, that's what collective action does. That's what people coming together and saying, you know what, we've had enough, we want piece of what we create. That's what that does. And I think it's so vitally important that we, as a nation, remember collective action. We need to make sure that we have the opportunity to say, you know what? We want what's rightfully ours. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
It's a beautiful day because working people are standing together. It's a beautiful day because working people are on the move together. See, we're taking a message across the country. Working people are taking action for a better life.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka speaking on the Philadelphia stop of the Give America a Raise bus tour. The bus rolls into Milwaukee today with support from Wisconsin Jobs Now, Wisconsin Citizen Action, the state AFL-CIO, and others. Trumka says there's a nationwide struggle underway to raise wages.
There's a new national debate going on right now. It's going on all across this country. It's about raising wages for hardworking people. It's about getting people a fair shake and justice and real benefits on the job. And while our leaders may be a little tone deaf to it, the working people out there are talking about raising their wages every single day, right? Yes.
According to MIT's Living Wage Calculator, a living wage in Milwaukee is $19,717. If a single full-time worker made $10.10 an hour, that annual wage would be $21,008. The University of Wisconsin's Center on Wisconsin Strategy says that boosting the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour would give more than 500,000 Wisconsin workers raises and would generate 3,800 jobs. For the fifth straight year, the United Auto Workers Union has added new members. The UAW report filed with the U.S. Department of Labor reported a net gain of nearly 9,000 members in 2013. Job creation under UAW collective bargaining agreements at the Detroit Three automakers since 2008, plus successful organizing in places like New York University, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Arlington, Texas, and Louisville, Kentucky, and also at casinos in Ohio and Las Vegas, all contributed to the UAW's five straight years of membership growth. UAW contracts have brought production of the Ford Fusion and medium-duty trucks from Mexico back to Michigan, and transit commercial van production back to Kansas City from Europe. UAW says there are thousands more workers who are still bargaining first contracts or who are represented by the union but have yet to sign union cards. When those are included, UAW membership is over 400,000. Tuesday in Wisconsin, 13 communities will vote on resolutions calling for a constitutional amendment to overturn the U.S. Supreme Court Citizens United decision allowing unlimited corporate money in politics. George Penn is with Move to Amend.
This movement is needed so that we can get our democracy back. Those of us of all stripes, conservative, independent, and liberals, realize that our country's politics has been co-opted by money. Ultimately, this was triggered by a decision by the Supreme Court called Citizens United that said you can't really limit money put into politics. And from that came this movement. We want to get a constitutional amendment that basically said two things. One, a corporation is not a person. And two, money is not speech.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
There is no other agency like the EPA. It should really be renamed the Job Killing Organization of America.
Because, brothers, it's bad. If we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did.
I got to tell you, I love Michelle Bachmann. I love Crazy. Crazy's good, just not in politics. Crazy's good in, you know, many facets in my life. Just not the people who are going to be deciding whether I'm going to be able to breathe clean air and drink water, clean water. But you listen to those on the right, the job killers, that we have regulations and standards. Not really looking at our trade policies, though, that they have championed for at least a generation now. And for years on this program, I've been saying that our free trade models are broken. The whole neoliberal trade experience, in my view, is a failure. We should scrap it. And, you know, 2008, President Obama was kind of speaking the same things, that we should be scrapping it. We should be going to another model. Maybe the kind that we had, oh, I don't know, from the beginning of the country until just before Clinton signed NAFTA. That might not be a bad idea. Anyway, that's why I have asked Ben Beachy's research director over at Public Citizens Global Trade Watch to come talk about a new report that they've put out that I think kind of highlights exactly that point. Ben, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure. Glad to be on.
You know, you look at this and we hear this myth that free trade's going to it's going to raise all boats and we're all going to prosper together and, you know, the tide's going to take us all up and it's rivers of gold and honey. Not so much, huh?
Yeah, well, the big promise that the Obama administration keeps on using to promote sweeping so-called treaty agreements, such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which I'm guessing most listeners know is a massive deal being proposed between the United States and 11 Pacific Rim countries. And the big promise made for the TPP, as it's called, is the same promise that was made for NAFTA, the same promise that was made for the Korea FTA, that this will boost exports, that will export our way to job creation. And export growth will increase, jobs will thus increase, and yes, all boats will rise. We've actually not seen that, though. The report that you just mentioned that we put out shows that we've actually had higher export growth with countries with which we've never signed a trade agreement than with countries with which we have signed a trade agreement. That is, our export growth to countries that are not trade agreement partners is 30% higher over the last decade than with our partners such as Mexico and Canada under NAFTA. And meanwhile, which is only one side of the coin, the other side is imports, of course. In the same way that exports could create jobs, imports can displace jobs. And we've seen that to an extreme degree under these trade agreements. We've actually seen the aggregate U.S. trade deficit with all of our free trade agreement partners, that's NAFTA partners, Korea, Colombia, all of them, all 20 partners combined, our deficit with them has increased, soared by more than $147 billion, while our deficit with non-free trade agreement countries has actually decreased by more than $130 billion. So it's a stark difference in that we've seen big import surges when we sign these kind of deals. And as everyone knows, that tends to displace jobs, as we've seen so painfully under 20 years of NAFTA.
So let me ask you this. So as you've said, that with the countries that we have signed these idiotic free trade agreements with, we're getting our behinds kicked. With countries that we don't have these agreements with, we're actually holding our own and doing a little bit better. So I guess two questions. One, why would we consider even the possibility of another neoliberal type free trade agreement? And I guess the more kind of ridiculous question is, how do we trade with anyone if we don't have an agreement?
You can, I'll answer the last question first. You can trade with people without these sweeping deals that go far beyond trade. And that's an actual response to your first question as well. Why would we push forward a deal after seeing this data? Well, because those that are pushing forward these kind of deals, like the TPP, aren't really all that concerned with traditional trade matters. Trade agreements these days are not really about cutting tariffs and just concerning the goods that are flying across borders. Trade agreements today have long patent extensions that have been pushed by pharmaceutical corporations that give them monopoly power over the drugs that they produce, which for the rest of us means higher medicine prices and fewer generics. These are agreements that have a mechanism known as investor state that empowers foreign firms to directly challenge, to essentially sue the government of a sovereign country over health or environmental rules that they find inconvenient before international tribunals. The TPP has terms in there that conflict with our efforts to rein in Wall Street, to re-regulate finance. There are terms in there that look like they're borrowed from the Stop Online Piracy Act, SOPA, that threatened internet freedom and failed in Congress. So these deals go far, far beyond I'll give you auto parts and you give me corn. This is no longer today much about trade, which might explain why these deals have actually not been all that great for boosting our exports, and why, even despite this data, you see this agenda still being pushed forward, because it's being pushed forward by the same corporations that are less concerned with traditional trade and more concerned with their narrow special interests that they've managed to get inserted into these deals.
Yeah, I mean, there's an awful lot there. And, I wanted to go back real quick because you talked about these tribunals. And I don't know if you saw it last week. A judge ruled that we citizens, consumers, actually have a right to know the origin of meat that we may buy. If we buy beef from Mexico, we should know that it's from Mexico. And one of my questions to the person that was explaining it to me is, now don't we open ourselves up to being sued in the tribunal, because isn't that an unfair trade restriction to people in Mexico? Because I'm not going to buy beef from Mexico.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and it's not a hypothetical one. We actually have a World Trade Organization case against us for that very policy. It's called country of origin labeling that tells us consumers where our meat comes from. And they actually already ruled against the United States, saying that was discrimination. To say that, it doesn't say don't buy meat from Mexico. It doesn't say don't buy meat from Canada. It just says, product of the USA. But they said that was discrimination. And then, thankfully, in response, the government didn't back down. The U.S. Department of Agriculture actually strengthened the labels. Now Canada and Mexico are coming at us again, saying, they're basically starting the process under which they could impose sanctions on the United States for having these labels, sanctions that would be authorized by the WTO, We have yet to see what the end of this case will bring. But what I mentioned for TPP is even worse than that. At least this is a WTO, a company would have to convince its government to go to bat for it against the United States. Under the TPP, any company, any corporation that's operating in any of the 11 companies that dislikes one of our environmental, health, financial, consumer protection laws could directly sue the United States government over that law.
Nice. That's what I like to hear.
Yeah.
We're going to have our tax dollars tied up in frivolous lawsuits on an international scale because the Indian tobacco company wants to sell tobacco to my 11-year-old daughter.
Yeah, tobacco is not a hypothetical either. Unfortunately, Philip Morris has used these extreme provisions to go after Australia. They have Australia's really strong plain packaging laws that have, like, for example, you know, the cigarette packages that say smoking kills in big, bold letters. They have a very strong law. Philip Morris fought all the way through a domestic court system and lost in Australia. And then they decided, well, I'll use this backdoor mechanism where I can present my case to a three-person tribunal, three private attorneys, and now the decision on whether or not that law is legit is a decision for those three private attorneys because of these so-called trade provisions.
So just so I get this right, because I want to go back to this because I think it's important. What your report is saying, that the countries that we have these free trade agreements with, and you have a chart that goes through them and shows the massive deficits that we have these free trade agreements that are supposed to act as a mechanism to make sure that trade is open and free, and we're getting our behinds kicked because these things are in my view, manipulated in a way to put us at a disadvantage. And in countries where we don't have these free trade agreements, we're actually doing quite well. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, I mean, the most astonishing thing of this, so there's two main parts. One is that our imports have surged under these free trade agreements, which is, a big job displacer when you don't have exports going up nearly as much as imports are going up. That means on net, the net effect has been massive job displacement. There's been over about $150 billion surge in the net effect. You could frame that as a loss of net exports since these free trade agreements have gone into effect. Meanwhile, you haven't had anything near that kind of deficit surge, and actually exports have increased more than imports have increased for our non-free trade agreement partners, which means that we've had net job creation, not net job loss. The second thing is that the whole claim for the Korea Free Trade Agreement, if you go to the government's webpage on the Korea Free Trade Agreement, it says more exports, more jobs. That was the promise.
Right.
And that's the same promise being used right now for the TPP. But we find that actually our exports are growing faster with countries with which we've never signed one of these deals. So that whole promise, that whole notion of why we're doing these, rather extraordinary deals that enshrine such privileges for so many different corporations is because we're going to boost our exports, and the data just simply doesn't support that.
So you look at all the jobs. I mean, I've seen numbers anywhere from 800,000 to 1 million jobs we've lost to Mexico because of NAFTA. You look at the jobs we've lost because of Korea. And I'm being told that this Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement is those on steroids. Not a good future for us with this line of thought.
No, I mean, to put it concretely, after NAFTA was passed, many auto parts companies, a lot of textile companies, a lot of manufacturing in the United States left and went to Mexico. It's in the hundreds of thousands of jobs. Different reports say different things, some up to 1 million just to Mexico. But jobs left. But they didn't stay in Mexico. Once China entered the World Trade Organization, many of those jobs left Mexico and went to China. So Mexican workers didn't exactly benefit from this either. But the thing is that China is not the bottom of the barrel either. One of the members of the Trans-Pacific Partnership is Vietnam, and Vietnam's wages are about a third. They're a fraction of the wages that are actually paid in China. And so you can imagine the kind of job flight we'll see in a deal that's signed with Vietnam.
Just bad, bad all the way around. And at the end of it, it's going to take us to stop it. So how do we do that?
Well, the real way to stop this is to make sure that Congress maintains their authority over trade, which is given by the Constitution. Now, there's a bill in Congress that would have Congress actually sign away their authority and sign full power to the president to negotiate the full Trans-Pacific Partnership, sign the deal, and then send it to Congress with sealed before Congress gets a vote. And when they do get a vote, they would have no amendments, very limited debate, and on an expedited timeline. That bill that would do all these extraordinary things is called Fast Track. And so the way to stop the TPP is to stop Fast Track, to make sure that Congress maintains its power to say, look, this trade deal threatens to increase the cost of medicines and roll back financial regulation and activities of internet freedom. We've got to look at this deal bit by bit. And so we need to stop Fast Track. And so the way to stop Fast Track, the best place to go that I would recommend is exposethetpp.org. That's exposethetpp.org. And then you can find out, you know, if your representative is on the right side and stopping Fast Track or not. And if not, you know, how you can write letters to the editor, lobby, you know, call your congressperson, et cetera, to get them on the right side.
I'm right there with you. We got to stop that to be right from the start. If you want more information, go to citizen.org/TradeWatch. Tons of information on how you can get involved and stop this in its tracks. Because it is, to steal a term from Michelle Bachmann, a job killer. Ben, great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Ben Beachy, research director over there at the Global Trade Watch, the Citizens Global Trade Watch. Quick break, back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Changing America for the better.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Jess Levin. On Fox News' Fox and Friends Sunday, co-host Anna Koyman and Independent Women's Forum Executive Director Sabrina Schaefer pushed several debunked minimum wage myths on the air.
The majority of minimum wage earners are working part-time. The majority are younger workers, 16 to 24, about 50% are. So it's not quite this dire situation where you have the head of households who are not able to care for their families. And there are, you know, when the price of something goes up, people tend to buy less.
So you're saying it's continuing this phony war on women?
Yeah, of course.
In fact, women make up the majority of minimum wage earners and would benefit much more from an increased minimum wage. According to research from the Center for American Progress, women make up 48.3% of the total workforce, yet two-thirds of minimum wage earners are women. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Ah, progress. In the 2012 elections, Republicans cast themselves as budget balancers by promising to whack welfare programs for the poor, snarling that such people are takers and moochers. Such vindictive sourness didn't play too well with voters, and Republicans now seem to have learned their lesson. Oh, they're still going after food stamps, school lunches, etc., with a vengeance, but this time with a gentle, even loving tone. The GOP's official message massagers now have their members saying that they want to, quote, help the poor by eliminating those programs, referring to them as soulless giveaways that sap their initiative and tether them to the cold, uncaring hand of government. The message is, we're doing this for the poor people's own good. Their chief budgeteer, Representative Paul Ryan, trotted out this theme at a recent right-wing rally, condemning school lunches as unloving Obama fare, plopped on plates by unsmiling cafeteria personnel. What they're offering people is a full stomach and an empty soul, he oozed. If that doesn't make you gag, try another subsidized lunch program that tender-hearted GOP budget whackers never mention, much less demand that it be eliminated. It's the tax subsidy for corporate meals, drinks, and entertainment. Multimillionaire CEOs can go wining and dining on your and my dime, writing off their high-dollar lunches, cocktails, dinners, and club hopping as a business expense. and expensive it is for us taxpayers, this subsidy adds up to more than $12 billion a year. And that doesn't count the human cost of executive initiative that is sapped by this giveaway, and the lack of love a CEO feels from being dependent on unsmiling taxpayers. This is Jim Hightower saying we ought to be subsidizing healthy meals for poor people, especially school kids, but not a dime for fat cat CEOs dining out at Chez Gourmand. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Claustrophobia, hypochondria, xenophobia, rolled up into one. Just saying, your car stays in mind and we won't bother anyone. Cause I'm afraid about the test of headlines. Please don't get too close to me. Please don't get too close to me.
No, no, don't sit next to me. No, bad. Oh, horrible public transportation. No. No, we can't do that. No, that would be horrible. We can't have buses and trains and high-speed rail. That'd be anti-American. We need to have big gas guzzlers. Come on, you know better, right? Or at least that's what the Koch brothers would have us believe. And oddly enough, and I guess it's not really surprising that people who made their billions in gas and oil and extraction, that they're going to want to continue that. It's no surprise that the front shill group, Americans for Prosperity, funded by the Koch brothers, are pushing the state of Tennessee to ditch the Nashville Mass Transportation Plan, known as AMP. Now, look, the state legislature, the Republican state legislature in Tennessee, you know, the ones who said, hey, workers, if you organize into a union, we'll not give your company any more sugar. No more sweeteners for your company. You know, I love the Uncle Sugar thing from Mike Huckabee. You want to talk about Uncle Sugar? Look at how much Uncle Sugar has given to big multinational corporations. But that's just that's a whole argument for another day. But anyway, Americans for Prosperity for the Koch brothers, they're out there lobbying heavily against the $174 million bus rapid transit project that Tennessee is attempting to put into place. Now, look, I'm of the mindset that's a good thing. Whenever you're making getting around a major metropolitan city easier for the residents, easier for people who need it, I think that's a pretty good thing, don't you? The folks from Americans for Prosperity, not so much. Prosperity for the Koch brothers. Not so much for you and me, but for them. They're the same people who have gone after, you know, the Obamacare. They've gone after everything to help workers. Now, to me, I look at this chance for Nashville to make this public transportation system work better for its citizens and create jobs and also help people get to jobs. You know, I grew up in a neighborhood when I was a kid. We weren't on the bus line. So if you didn't have a car, you were screwed. You were left out of the economic opportunities that most of us who do have transportation, we take for granted. The fact that Nashville was thinking about this, I think is huge. I think it's enormous. But what you end up with is you end up with the Cokehead brothers who are saying, no, it's not in our interest. And what's only important is that our interest. Now, the Senate bill, evidently, that would stop this $174 million project, completely different from the House version, which would make it illegal for buses to pick up or drop off passengers in the center lane of one of the main roads there. So they've added these little things. Well, we can't have that. That would be bad. And, you know, again, you do what you can to block. They do what they can to obstruct. They do what they can to destroy because they stand to benefit. And the other part of this, and I haven't been able to find this yet, but it's my understanding that this would be a local system, that this would not be something that would be privatized. From the articles that I've been looking through and what I have found, there's a lot to this to me. Now, there's a part of me that says, well, maybe the Koch brothers are holding on for, hey, maybe we get our claws in this. You know, it kind of makes you wonder. And as you pay attention to what these front groups are doing, and this is what gets me, man. It gets me into this position where there are so many things that we need. There are so many things as a society that we need to be investing in. Public transportation being one of them. Broadband internet access being another of them. And as you look it through all of this stuff, and who are the people trying to stop it? And who are their shills? Who are the people they put out in front? I mean, you saw that troll from Pennsylvania's Americans for Prosperity. And I don't even give her time because, look, she is what she is. She's out there to inflame. She's out there to enrage. And she's out there to try and get a couple of minutes for herself. Hey, look at me. And she does, hey, look at me, pretty well. Because she says some of the most outlandish, some of the most outrageous things. And if you remember last week when we talked a little bit about it, and I try not to talk much about it, but if you remember, you know, talking just a little bit about it, it was really one of those moments where you go, explain to me how it is that Obamacare is denying a mother a choice to not insure her children. Because that's in essence what she said. As a mother, he's denying me the choice to not insure my kids. So if you don't have it, you should have the choice not to? Very strange arguments. But these are what we get from these Koch brother groups. This is what we get from the billionaire groups. It's really about just dividing us. It's really about, and I go back to LBJ's decision today back in 68 to not seek re-election for the unity of the country. Groups like this, they're hell-bent on continuing the divide, growing that gulf between us larger and larger, so that if they can segment us off, if they can faction us off, they can keep us pitted against one another. Now, you look at the big moneyed interest who are funding this. Now, there's a big website that I did get a couple of minutes to look at, stopamp.org, which evidently was put forth by one of the auto dealers, the big auto dealers in the area. Gee, I wonder why. I wonder why an auto dealer would want you not to have a public transportation system. Huh. I gotta wonder. Can you think of something? Because I'm blank. I guess I'm just fresh out of ideas on why guys who sell oil and guys who sell cars, you gotta wonder, gee, why would they be against public transportation? Huh. I'm blank. What about you? I'm fresh out of ideas. Might as well throw in the guy who sells tires. Might as well throw in the guy who makes asphalt. I can't figure out why they would be against it either. Gee, I wonder why the people who have lots of money, why would they be out there funding groups to stop the advancement of our society? Gee, I wonder why. I'm sure you understand this is all tongue-in-cheek. You know why. It's the money. It's profit over people. It's them over us. That's the reality. Because they live in different worlds. And when I was in Toledo the weekend before last, you know, you saw very much two worlds. Big, enormous, beautiful houses of people who had really good, high-paying jobs. And then blight. Segregated off. And it made me go, you know, there was a time when those people all lived in eyeshot of each other. And I think we need that great compression. I think we need that again. Just that simple. I'll take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK.
We can. can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
There are a lot of folks named Bill Jones, but likely only one kept classified photographs secret for more than 40 years. Bill Jones of Stark County, Indiana, was a military photographer, and though he gained some fame from it, it was not what he wanted to do. Jones had a passion for airplanes and wanted to fly them. He took pilot training at Bearfield in 1944, but his rheumatic fever as a child kept his weight too low to ever become an Air Force pilot. Still, Jones's desire to fly is what led him to his moment in history. He went on to spend 6 months in aerial photography in B-17 aircraft, and that was the beginning of a trail that would take him and his cameras to some of the most fascinating scenes in the world's history. Join us again next time for Jones's most famous photographs. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
There isn't anyone immune from globalization. In fact, the confluence of greed and geography blends seamlessly over all of humanity. As the American workforce has become more sophisticated and smart, corporations have become less agreeable. Of course, there were numerous road signs that led to globalization, and at this point, somewhat improbable that any single cause could be raised from the economic wreckage it has created. However, 1976 may have been a high watermark for the American economy, where a change in the tax code emboldened corporations to move more operations overseas. Where these gutless entrepreneurs once shuttered factories in the Northeast and moved them to southern localities, they were now served up by the U.S. Congress, a world plate, where even to their insatiable greed, the possibilities seemed limitless. The assault on American workers continued in the 1980s when the Reagan administration further retooled the tax code to allow foreign investors to set up American subsidiaries, thereby artfully managing the exodus of U.S.-based corporations. The unseemly alliance between Congress and corporations offers little solace to workers, but does shine a perpetual light on the misgivings of unregulated money flowing into the pockets of greedy politicians. Unions, while greatly weakened over the last two decades, continue to mount credible defenses, proposing balance, equity, and fairness for workers over the broader brush of Congress that would have us believe that globalization can regulate itself. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Minute is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So it was today, back in 1840, the president then, Martin Van Buren. How many people are going to remember that name? But Martin Van Buren issued a broadly acceptable executive order. And what did he do? He granted all government employees engaged in manual labor the right to a 10-hour day. And it makes me think, does government have the power, should they have the power to level the playing field? Should they have the power to raise conditions, raise wages? If you listen to the right wing in this country, no, can't have that. The free market will destroy your conditions. Thank you very much. Government should stay neutral. And here you listen to some legislators here in Pennsylvania. They believe government should be the leader in the race to the bottom. So I look at this and I go, you know, shouldn't we be, as a nation, saying that our tax dollars should be used to make conditions better, safer, maybe just a thought? Well, the folks over at Fake News on Fox think not. And I saw this article by Josh Idelson, a reporter over at Salon, that I thought, you know, this is something we absolutely need to talk about, which is why I've asked Josh on the program. Josh Idelson, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me back, Rick. Good to be with you again.
You know, so I look at this piece you've done, and fantastic work. I follow your work all the time. I wish we had thousands more reporters like Josh Idelson to follow these stories. But I look at this, and I look at these stories that Fake News on Fox puts out, saying, "Oh, we're crushing these poor companies with these overburdensome regulations." We're not doing that.
It's really something. It's really something because here is a situation, here's a workplace where, according to the allegations of the workers that I spoke to, workers who were willing to share their name, identify themselves in order to speak up about what they say is taking place here, you have a company doing nearly everything in its power to keep safety risks, to keep illegal safety risks from coming to light and being exposed by the government. And the way that Fox News chooses to enter this story, now, presumably they had not spoken to these workers, but the way that this company lands on Fox News is not because Fox News looked into whether there was any intimidation going on in this non-union workplace against the people who work there who handle these chemicals that workers say leave their hands all beat up. But rather, Fox News is worried that this poor little company is being harassed and intimidated by the government because the company had to suffer the indignity of having inspectors from OSHA come and see whether or not they were following the law. And so you have a real outrage segment on Fox and Friends in which a host and an expert are talking about, in their terms, blackmail, a protection racket, the government singing look for the union label, all out of outrage over the idea that a union, on the one hand, could help workers instigate an OSHA complaint, and on the other hand, at the request of people who work there, could send someone to accompany the inspector, even if that's what the workers wanted.
Well, I mean, that's all job-killing regulation. And when you have a network hell-bent on right-wing ideology, you start with the ideology of all regulation is bad and any action is anti-corporation and anti-profit, and then you work backward from there. It's nothing new, I don't think.
I think ideology is an interesting lens to bring into this because there is an ideology in this country where a certain number of people believe that the only kind of coercion that matters, the only kind of coercion that is suspect, the only kind of coercion that we need to guard against is the government coercing other people. That OSHA inspector being able to come into that facility, even though professional janitorial services doesn't want it, is the threat to freedom that we have to look out of. And of course, there are cases where the government does terrible and coercive things. But the people who are on Fox News about that coercion show really no interest in the tremendous power that a boss has over a worker by virtue of the fact that they can fire them or they can make them miserable if they don't do exactly what they would like them to do. And here we have a situation where in order to defy the government in the government's role of overseeing and regulating safety on the job, a manager allegedly is using that tremendous private coercion power in order to push back against the government's ability to help workers keep themselves safe.
Which is why exactly in 1935 when they passed the Wagner Act, they gave not one single syllable, not one single word of rights to employers. The original National Labor Relations Act gave workers some bit of rights because they understood back then that employers had all the rights. And what the National Labor Relations Act did is gave employees, workers, people like you and me, a little bit, just some right to sit at the table and negotiate for wages, hours, and conditions. And it's odd to me at this point in our history that we've forgotten that we've forgotten the conditions from which we've come. And it appears we're heading back to the conditions that what made us go and pass the National Labor Relations Act.
Well, the creakiness and the cravenness of the labor law we have now, this is something you and I have gotten to talk about before, how broken or fixed the labor law has become, in part because of all the ways that both politicians and courts have changed the meaning and effectively the intent of the Labor Relations Act, is you have a situation now where in order to get a company to lay down their arms and agree not to terrorize workers, increasingly it's necessary to find a whole bunch of weapons with which to pressure the company into choosing not to mount a union-busting campaign. So conservatives, if they were fully articulating the argument that was made on Fox News, if you made them explicate it, then presumably what they would say is, well, how outrageous that unions opportunistically seize on things that companies may be doing wrong in order to pressure those companies into letting workers organize.
And rest assured, Josh, if you saw the story in Mississippi last week, eventually that will be illegal too.
Well, we've seen, as with anything that unions do that's effective or workers do that's effective, people try to make illegal, whether it's the application of RICO law to corporate campaigns or the attempts, whether it was this year or a couple years ago in state legislatures to make it nearly impossible to legally picket. And so this tactic, of course, big business lobbyists hate the fact that unions exploit crimes or alleged crimes by companies in order to squeeze them to give something up in terms of the right to organize. But if you believe that safety violations are bad and you believe that robust organizing rights are good, then it is not at all clear that opportunistically using some safety violations in order to pressure a company into respecting people's organizing rights is a bad thing. And in fact, even if you don't win those organizing rights, the collateral damage, so to speak, here is a company might be forced to stop doing something that is illegal and dangerous.
And harmful to their employees.
Right. And so we see this with all kinds of corporate misdeeds, whether you're talking about sex discrimination or you're talking about environmental pollution or you're talking about wage theft. Given the condition of regulation in this country, given the condition of enforcement, often the things that we might imagine that it is up to the government to catch people doing and punish people for doing, they only get caught doing or punished for doing, they being the CEOs and the executives here, if a union that has an additional motive in terms of organizing those workers does the work of the research and the groundwork and the muckraking and the getting people to come into the light and share their story, even when they might lose their job, to expose this kind of wrongdoing.
You know, I look at this, and one of the things that caught my attention is, you know, this, you know, we're harassing these companies, and we're doing all this legal, the blackmailing these companies, and all of this stuff. What happens when people die on the job? What happens to them and their families? You know, you saw with, and you brought it up in your article about, you know, the Mine Safety and Health Administration. What happens when you have a mine explosion and people die? Does anyone go to jail? Do we then throw those companies in jail? And the answer is no, we don't.
Right. Over and over, we see the tremendous disparities and the unfortunate values that statement that gets made about what gets someone thrown in jail, what gets someone serious penalty, and what doesn't. And we have seen, certainly in the past several years, what not only corporate executives, but bankers and any number of other very privileged and very powerful people can get away with compared to, say, a teenager who smokes pot. So the fact that executives and management at professional janitorial services are faced with some extra heat over allegations that are serious, allegations that in some cases OSHA validated as serious, things like making people use chemicals without having sufficient training in how to use them, the fact that those may come back to haunt the company, and they may come back to haunt that particular company, in part because that particular company is also the largest non-union janitorial company in the Houston area, and SEIU would like to organize it. If you look at the situation and say, oh, the miscarriage of justice here is that the union, by bringing these workers forward and helping them with the paperwork, was able to get OSHA to come and look at that company, then I question your sense of moral priority.
No, I'm with you. And the thing that gets me is, you know, you said that the companies will be held responsible. And the sad reality is we don't hold companies responsible. I mean, you look at, for instance, in Texas, you know, we visited the space that the fertilizer plant that blew up in West Texas, blowing a hole in the earth 10 feet deep, 93 feet around, you know, blew a school off of its foundation, blew the roof off of a nursing home in a community, just left hollow. I didn't see anybody go to jail. I didn't see anybody held responsible for the numerous deaths and the destruction. And the company just filed bankruptcy. You look at Freedom Water or Freedom Industries, who brought us, you know, the wonder of uncontrollable vomiting from drinking water out of our tap. They filed bankruptcy, and their CEO, he wants to be paid. We don't hold these companies accountable, Josh.
So people who want to rhapsodize about the private sector could take note that in all kinds of situations, we see that when it comes to punishing corporations for doing things most Americans would not approve of, often it is people taking up private sector remedies through the form of protest and boycott and strike and squeezing in media. That is what people turn to, particularly because of the limited kind of enforcement that's out there, whether you're talking about people occupying homes to stop foreclosures or you're talking about Walmart workers going out on strike to try to squeeze and expose the company for firing Walmart workers who went out on strike. In each of these cases, the not only is there not the heavy hammer that we're being warned about on Fox News of government when it comes to something like people not following the law of what would keep their workers safe, there is, you know, arguably not even a pencil or a little screwdriver, let alone a hammer.
Now, I mean, the thing that gets me, Josh, is we are eons away from the Teddy Roosevelt era, where he said if he was a factory worker or worked on the railroad, he would most certainly join the union of his trade. We're definitely light years away from the Eisenhower years of anyone who would come out against unemployment or Social Security or labor laws would never be heard from. And the few that there are, their number, they're stupid. We're eons from those folks.
You know, I had the opportunity to write often about the opportunities that exist for the federal government to side itself decidedly for the Democratic president and his administration to take a stance that would support the stated promise of the National Labor Relations Act on any number of issues, whether you're talking about trade policy or you're talking about protections for LGBT employees of federal contractors. And certainly we are not in the era of having a government that is unabashedly on the side of workers, though I'm not convinced that we ever were. But it is worth noting that this story, this PJS story, starts with a year ago when the United Steelworkers reached out and asked OSHA to clarify if the workers have the right, pending OSHA's agreement, pending the inspector's agreement, to bring someone along who they'll feel comfortable having come and inspect their workplace, then does that include someone who works for a labor union? And OSHA made a good call and said, sure, if the workers want to have someone from a labor union there, even if they're so-called non-union workers and a non-union workplace, and the inspector agrees, then bring them in. As Jordan Barab of OSHA said to me, sometimes people feel more comfortable talking to an inspector from the government, again, at their workplace, when they have that person from that union who, even if they don't have a collective bargaining agreement, even if they don't have union recognition, they have some relationship with. And so OSHA made a good call here, a little notice call at the time, which apparently not coincidentally is stirring up a firestorm on the right now with the Daily Caller article and National Review article in Fox and Friends segment. And so it's a story that has a piece that you will not see in that right-wing media, or you haven't so far. And a piece that's important because it reminds us that coercion takes different forms. And it reminds us something about who actually wields power often in a workplace in the U.S.
Yeah, so let me ask you this then. The takeaway from this is, for me, if what I'm hearing, what you're saying is accurate, the takeaway is if I'm working in crummy conditions, then not only can I call, you know, OSHA or someone, I can actually call maybe a union to come and help me and my fellow workers get someone to inspect and get someone to straighten things out.
Well, of course, it's always been true that you can call a union along with calling OSHA, and it has increasingly been true the past couple decades that in order to get the company to not terrorize you out of organizing, the union, if it's smart, will look for any kind of legal and moral weapon it can come up with to pressure that company, including figuring out what that company is doing wrong in every other way. What is now true is that if you and that union get some charges filed with OSHA, then you have the option, if OSHA is going to inspect, to ask that someone from that union come along and observe that inspection, and that inspector has the authority to say, sure, bring them along with you. And the idea that if that happens, the person who is going to feel the most intimidated in all of this is the boss and not the worker who has put themselves out there is, I think, a misrepresentation or to be more generous, a misunderstanding of the power relationships on the shop floor in the U.S.
Of course, the article titled Fox and Friends, Poster Child Accused of Bullying Employees Over Safety Risks, the exclusive over at Salon, written by Josh Idelson. Josh, great work. I appreciate you taking time for us, and we'd love to have you back again real soon.
Thanks. I'd love to do it.
All right, Josh. Thanks so much. Quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
Stand up. Stand up for your right. Yeah, if more people would do that, I think. You say enough already. Yeah, we're not going to allow it to happen. And, you know, I go back to in my early working career, I worked for a warehouse company, huge retail chain, their distribution center. And I remember, and I fairly vividly, the shop guys, the maintenance guys, were non-union. And as hard as they tried to organize them, they just couldn't. There was like six guys, and four of them were just, you know, they were well taken care of. They had their gig. Turns out two of them were robbing the place blind, but that's a whole nother discussion for another day. But I remember one of the guys was told by, you know, the head maintenance guy, take that 55-gallon drum of oil from the tow motors. And just go dump it out in the field there. You know, up by the highway, just dump it out by the highway, out in the field there. Make sure nobody sees you. Just take the tow, take it out there and just dump it. Which they had done, I guess, a number of times. And as I remember it, and this is one of those things where you go and you say, hey, how did it get stopped? The guy told me, I told the steward. The steward then got involved, and somehow it didn't get dumped. Because you had someone who was going, hey, wait a second. That's not a good idea. Don't do that. The sunlight, the light of day, you know, the sanitizing effect of, hey, someone knows, and someone has the ability to make sure that you are punished for it. And, you know, I said, at the time, you were protecting the company from itself. The very minor savings. I mean, you're probably talking $100 of disposing the oil properly. And the cost that it would have been for just dumping it out in the field to get rid of it were in two different, entirely different leagues. Completely in different atmospheres. And you go, well, why would somebody want to do that? I have no idea why they were doing it. It was just something that maybe they always did it. Who knows? But I know when it stopped. And you hear that often. Well, the company's going to act in its own best interest. Yeah. its own best interest that it doesn't have to spend $100. And as you look at what's gone on the last several years, especially since the Bush years, where they really went after OSHA and this whole assault on any regulatory body, the assault on any type of oversight, the gutting of budgets. As you look at this, you go, well, the punishment's getting less and less. The severity of the fines, less and less. And if you do what the mining companies did, every citation, everything that they were issued, they fought just to clog up the mechanism to hold them accountable, which they did because they have a ton of money. Then it gums the process up even more. And they know how to gum the system up, so it's basically broken. Which is why I've said, if I really ever wanted to kill somebody, I would just say, hey, come work for me. And set up a condition that, well, you know, hey, something fell off a shelf. Well, how was I supposed to know? Because that's, you know, what we've allowed these companies to get away with for way too long. Under the guise of business friendly. Oh, Rick, we got to be business friendly. Well, what if you were that company? Well, I would want to make sure that my competitor was playing by the same rules that I'm playing by. Because at the end of it, if we allow one bad actor, the guy that's competing against him has to be a bad actor too. And you end up with who's going to be the worst bad actor? Because if you allow bad behavior, if you allow illegal behavior to continue, if you allow unsafe conditions, if you allow poor wage structures, if you allow all of the things that have gone on, these the destruction of pensions, if you allow this stuff to continue, what do you end up with? You end up with the society that we are moving towards. And for me, the idea that our tax dollars be used in a way to raise the economy up, the idea that our tax dollars be used to ensure a minimum basic standard of living, seems like common sense to me. Seems like things that Republicans of the past would have supported. When Teddy Roosevelt said, I would have joined the union if I were working on the railroads. I'd join the union if I was in the mines or in the factories because they have my interest at heart. Because they're going to make my life better. When Eisenhower said to his brother, you know, anybody who's against unemployment or Social Security or labor laws, their numbers are negligible and they're stupid. You go, what happened to the GOP? I'll tell you what happened to them. And a large number of Democrats. I'll tell you what happened to them. Bought and paid for. Huge moneyed special interest. Koch brother money. Sheldon Adelson money. Huge, huge money. They don't need workers. They don't need you and me, which is why I keep saying we better figure out how to get organized. We had better figure out how to come together on these issues and stop being divided, stop being sliced and diced and, oh, this or oh, that or oh, here's the shiny thing over here, stupid, while they're robbing us freaking blind. Really, at some point, we got to say enough, right? Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher, on the smartphone. You can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
It's a beautiful day because working people are standing together. It's a beautiful day because working people are on the move together. Yeah.
See, we're taking a message across the country. Working people are taking action for a better life.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka speaking on the Philadelphia stop of the Give America a Raise bus tour. The bus rolls into Milwaukee today with support from Wisconsin Jobs Now, Wisconsin Citizen Action, the state AFL-CIO, and others. Trumka says there's a nationwide struggle underway to raise wages.
There's a new national debate going on right now. It's going on all across this country. It's about raising wages for hardworking people. It's about getting people a fair shake and justice and real benefits on the job. And while our leaders may be a little tone deaf to it, the working people out there are talking about raising their wages every single day, right?
Yes. According to MIT's Living Wage Calculator, a living wage in Milwaukee is $19,717. If a single full-time worker made $10.10 an hour, that annual wage would be $21,008. The University of Wisconsin's Center on Wisconsin Strategy says that boosting the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour would give more than 500,000 Wisconsin workers raises and would generate 3,800 jobs. For the fifth straight year, the United Auto Workers Union has added new members. The UAW report filed with the U.S. Department of Labor reported a net gain of nearly 9,000 members in 2013. Job creation under UAW collective bargaining agreements at the Detroit Three automakers since 2008, plus successful organizing in places like New York University, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Arlington, Texas, and Louisville, Kentucky, and also at casinos in Ohio and Las Vegas, all contributed to the UAW's five straight years of membership growth. UAW contracts have brought production of the Ford Fusion and medium-duty trucks from Mexico back to Michigan, and transit commercial van production back to Kansas City from Europe. UAW says there are thousands more workers who are still bargaining first contracts or who are represented by the union but have yet to sign union cards. When those are included, UAW membership is over 400,000. Tuesday in Wisconsin, 13 communities will vote on resolutions calling for a constitutional amendment to overturn the U.S. Supreme Court Citizens United decision, allowing unlimited corporate money in politics. George Penn is with Move to Amend.
This movement is needed so that we can get our democracy back. Those of us of all stripes, conservative, independent, and liberals, realize that our country's politics has been co-opted by money. Ultimately, this was triggered by a decision by the Supreme Court called Citizens United that said you can't really limit money put into politics. And from that came this movement. We want to get a constitutional amendment that basically said two things. One, a corporation is not a person. And two, money is not speech.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
I got a pancake. I'm turning it up. It's been calling me. So fire it up. I got a pancake. I'm turning it up. It's been calling me. So somebody fire it up.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So tomorrow, I understand, there's going to be a rally of sorts at the Capitol here in Harrisburg, where one of the mothers whose son was killed up in Connecticut by the guy who went and killed all these kids in the school. She's going to be testifying on sane, rational gun laws and background checks and all of that stuff. And it got me to thinking about, you know, we've seen an awful lot of these stories of people, you know, either going crazy and shooting a bunch of people, or some, you know, is there some weird psychosis? Is it pathology? What is it that, why we've seen the number of these high-profile murders happen, why the number of these mass killings seems to be more prevalent, and or is it? Which is why we have asked Dr. Billy Gordon, UCLA professor of brain science, and also a psychiatrist studying studies of mass murderers. Professor Gordon, thanks for taking time for us.
Okay, before there's another murder in Los Angeles, I need to kind of correct my credentials.
Hit me.
Okay, I'm not a professor. I know to people in the way that, you know, anybody that's at a university that might walk in front of a classroom is a professor, but I'm not a professor, and I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm a PhD in neuroscience. I specialize in the study of the human brain. And it's a thin difference. And I mean, the difference is I don't write prescriptions to people for Prozac.
Okay, so before when the show's over, I'm going to kill my producer. How's that?
No, don't do that. Don't do that. No, it's too good of a show. And, you know, it's hard to do a show from prison.
There you go. But I understand. I understand. I could write a blog like The Son of Sam, who no longer wants to be called The Son of Sam. He wants to be known as The Son of Hope because he's a born-again Christian, evidently.
Well, you know, I went to this blog, and it's for sale.
Oh, that's a shame.
Well, no, I've never even known anyone to have a blog for sale. I'd love to sell my blog on Psychology Today. I don't know who would buy it, but if anybody, any of your listeners want to buy it, it's for sale.
There you go. good capitalist. There you go.
Yeah, exactly. Well, but actually, chronic episodic violence syndrome, which is what technically serial killers are, is my area of expertise, and one of my areas of expertise, and that's what I received a lot of training in, and I've done a lot of work with, actually with the FBI, with Quantico, and with the Behavioral Sciences Unit, and I've actually spoken with many serial killers and communicated with many serial killers. So even though I'm not a professor and I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm your go-to guy.
All right, good. So now that we've got that out of the way and corrected, and thank you for correcting us, because one of the things I like to be above all else is at least accurate. Are we seeing more of this? Is this something, is this increasing, or is it just something that we're seeing more because our media is reporting on it, as this stuff happens?
Well, I think that it's kind of a little bit of both. I think there's probably more mass murders because you have more disenfranchised people, and I think that's, endemic of the society. And I think that right now people are very disenfranchised. You know, America's in a very shaky spot. I mean, the world's in a shaky spot. And, everything is unsettled. And what you generally have with mass murderers is you have people that, are part of the quote unquote dominant culture that, have been left behind and they're angry and they go out and they take out their rage. That's the typical profile of your mass murderer, the kind of person who walks into the McDonald's and sandwich pizza and, you know, kills a bunch of people. And so that's a little bit different than your serial killer. I mean, both of those people obviously have something, some issues going on in their brain, but the mass murderer, I think it's much different because it's just a type of rage. It's a rage towards society. Whereas with the serial killer, and I don't even like that term, but we're just going to use that because that's what people know. But with a serial killer, it's different. You know, each serial killer is different. And, you know, it's always the same thing. It's always genetics, which is nature, and influenced by the developmental experiences or nurture. And so and there's a lot of things that can feed into it. Like, for example, Manson. Manson, terrible nutrition. Nutrition is extremely important to any mother will tell you. Nutrition is important to a developing child.
Right.
And when you deprive children of nutrition, things will happen. So people say, so, you know, why isn't every poor kid grow up to be a serial killer? Because, you know, it takes a lot of roads to finally lead to Rome. You have to get on the right road, you know. And
so the Twinkie defense, not something you'd advocate for?
You know, I can't say because I really am not that familiar with that thing. I think I might have even been living in San Francisco when that happened, but I just was not paying attention to it, and I'm not exactly sure what the particulars are. So I'm not comfortable saying I wouldn't advocate for it because I don't know. So
I shouldn't even use that, or the ding-dong defense, or anything where it's just bad diet.
I don't think that there's any one thing. I mean, yeah, I could... you know, I could eat some bad food and get indigestion, but does that give me the right to go out and run over somebody on the street? No. And so, I mean, I think that a lot of times lawyers do dances around a lot of things. And no, I have a hard time with that. You're right.
No,
I mean, it's not something I would go over. What I'm saying is that it's usually a number of things. It's usually an aggregate. It's like what you have is you have, like, bad nutrition. And then, like, with Manson, you know, they used to dress him up like a girl, and they used to, you know, and he was humiliated. So, you know, and I'm even thinking, to me, Manson is a low-rate serial killer because he actually didn't really do much on his own.
Right.
You know, I much prefer someone like Ed Kemper, who, prefer that.
You prefer? Okay, that's
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and I heard that it was coming out of my mouth. I thought, oh, okay, this is half the people switched off the radio and went, okay, Mr. Creepy's on. But what I meant is Ed Kemper is an interesting serial killer because he drove all around California. He's very prolific. He killed lots of girls, and he would cut off their feet and cut off their hands. And they took, you know, he was in Atascadero, the state hospital here, and for the criminally insane. And they treated him for a long time, and then they were treating him on an outpatient basis. And he went for his final exit interview, and he said, and he went through the whole thing, and he said, oh, yeah, you're fine, you're released. And then he went out, and he had the head of his mother in his trunk.
Wow.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about him was that his mother was a prostitute, and she would bring the men back to the room, and sometimes the men would abuse her, and they would take the money back, and they, you know, he'd try to defend his mom, and they'd slap him around. Sometimes the men would try sexual things with him, and there'd be issues. And, but anyway, at any rate, he was seeing his mother have sex with numerous amounts of men. So he grew up, and he started killing women, and he would cut off their hands, and he would cut off their feet. And so I was talking to one of the people at Atascadero, and they go, you know, we never figured that out. And I said, really? My goodness, it's like really obvious. And he said, why? And I said, well, he'd cut off the women's feet because obviously he was, whenever a serial killer, their victims are always archetypes of something that they're trying to make peace with. And so, and here's the issue with his mother. So he would cut off the feet so that she couldn't go and get the terror that would bring, that would come back to him. And he would cut off her hand, I mean, cut off the hands because she couldn't take the money. So without hands, she couldn't take the money. Without feet, she couldn't leave to go get the monster.
Nah.
And so, yeah, so that, I mean, that was, they were like, oh, wow. You know, that's like, and I was like, duh. I mean, you know, Stevie Wonder could have seen that. But,
But what got me is he's on an outpatient basis. The guy who killed people. What's he doing on an outpatient basis?
Well, you know, see, this is what happens to people. You know, they go and they go to the hospital and they don't go to jail. And so, you know, he's sent to a hospital because it's insane. You know, it's a McNaughton principle. And it's like, you know, which is an archaic thing from England that, you know, for the criminally insane. And it's ludicrous to even think about it because anybody that kills someone is insane. Okay? Even maybe not insane all the time, but at that moment, they're insane. Unless it's a situation like you wake up and Son of Sam is standing over your bed. You know, then that's a whole different thing. But anybody that goes out and aggressively kills someone, it's a moment of insanity for whatever reason.
Right, okay.
And so, and people, you know, and what do we do as a society? I'm not big for putting people in prison and just, you know, housing them in prison. And I think it's better to study people and to put them in hospitals. And I know a lot of people go, but, you know.
But not on an outpatient basis.
No. It's certainly not on an outpatient basis. But he was there for a long time. I mean, he was there for like 20 years. And, you know, or however many years. And then they let him out because they felt, you know, psychiatrist's conceit, we have healed him. You know, so now he's free to go. You know, so that's what they do. I mean, that's what happens.
Yeah, so let's talk about your work, because I find what you're doing fascinating. You do MRIs of these people's brains, and are you trying to figure out if their brains are structurally different, and I guess, are they structurally different, and if so, what are you finding that's different?
Okay. See, again, you know, not good information got to you. I don't do MRIs of serial killers. I don't know anyone who's really had a serial killer in an MRI.
Okay.
I mean, because it's like you'd be hard-pressed to get a serial killer to, like, steal an MRI. Probably the only serial killer that would have done it would have been Jeffrey Dahmer. Unfortunately, the state of Wisconsin was very irresponsible with him and put him in prison in the general population when
right.
he got killed. And so, which is a shame because he was willing to be studied. And so I don't actually put serial killers. I do MRIs or other things. And also, too, you know, you can put a serial killer in an MRI. Here's the thing about MRI. You have to learn to be a real good consumer of that data because everybody has an MRI study. Goes, oh, this is what we found. You know, MRI is very sophisticated equipment, and we've had it for a while, but we don't understand it that well in terms of, like, you know, understanding exactly what you're seeing.
Good, good.
You know, I could put you in an MRI right now, and I could say anything, any kind of study, and find some brain region that's going to light up, because the brain is always lighting up. You know, so there's a lot of things. So you have to be careful how you query that data.
Good.
And even to put a serial killer in an MRI, the only thing you could really find is some type of structural damage. I mean, maybe you could give them some type of simple task to see how they respond, or give them some anger task to see. But, I mean, you don't even really need an MRI to figure out that serial killers are going to have issues. Because most serial killers, what happens, in order for a person to be able to kill like that, is there's an area of the brain called the amygdala. And it's called the amygdala because that's Greek for almond, something that you didn't need to know. A little nerd fact.
Okay.
And so, because it's shaped like an almond. And it's a bunch of little nuclei. And one side of it governs aggression, and the other side governs sex. And the amygdala signals the hypothalamus, which signals a whole physiological sequelae of, like, you know, bodily events. So, like, if you're having sex, what do? Your blood pressure rises, you start to breathe heavily, you get excited, you get adrenaline. When you start to kill somebody, you use the exact same physiological mechanism. And if there's a breach in that pathway, then you cannot tell the difference between having sex and killing somebody. So for these people, it is the ultimate sexual satisfaction.
Huh. Well, maybe I'll find that out later when I kill my producer. I'm just kidding. But at the end of this, I mean, there are a lot of interesting questions that come up, because I got to be honest, I was worried that you were going to say, oh, we have these MRIs, and now we know, and we're going to start screening you because we're going to be able to try and tell who the serial killers are. That's the kind of stuff that freaks me out and scares me.
Oh, no. You know, there's a whole long list of things. You know, yeah, they say, like, oh, well, serial killers tend to have the third toe tends to be longer. Okay. That's fine. And they tend to be hyper-religious. Well, you know, lots of people, a lot of them have schizophrenic tendencies. Most schizophrenics are hyper-religious or certainly hypergraphic and write a lot. You know, serial killers, you know, they're intense. They're intensely insane. So, yeah, they drive for miles and miles and miles and miles. And, you know, they might drive 400 miles in a night and not even think about it. You know, just like you or I would go out for just a regular little drive. And so they do all types of things, and each serial killer is, you know, very different. It's like John Wayne Gacy. John Wayne Gacy was like, you know, he was like, I'm fine. All I really ever did was run a graveyard without a license. That's the only bad thing that I ever did. And even when he was in prison, he was still trying to seduce this one boy. You know, I mean, that was his whole thing. You know, he just had to do that because he was so angry with his father. And, you know, and he didn't kill all the boys. He just killed the ones that that were assholes, that reminded him of, I can't say bad words on the air.
Yeah, dump that.
Yeah, sorry. He just killed the ones that weren't nice and polite. And so, so they had to remind him of his father for him to kill him. So each one has a thing, you know, so each one has this, like, you know, when they go, people go out and they start to serial kill, they're trying to release a rage, you know, because it's a psychic pain that they have. So in my opinion, are they sick people? Yes. I mean, Son of Sam, was he upset? Yeah, he was upset because he was an illegitimate child. So what did he do? He went out and found people having sex in cars, and so he was basically killing his mother and his father for his pain because his brain was broken.
Wow.
And so, you know, and the sad thing about that is that that part of the brain that does that is that's the old mammal brain. And that part of the brain, when it takes over, it doesn't think. You know, it just does. Because if his cortex would be in there, he would go, this is not my mother.
So they can't help themselves is what you're saying, though.
What I'm saying is they can't help themselves. That is what I'm saying.
So then the vindictive part of us, the folks that we want to make sure that we lock them up forever and throw away the key, which I have a tendency of following along that line. I'm not big on executing them, but locking them up and keeping them from society, I think, is a good idea, right?
Yeah. I mean, if someone has leprosy, that's a really terrible thing. Or someone has some other really infectious disease, that's really terrible. But you're not going to let them walk through a school cafeteria. You're not going to let them take the subway. You know, you're going to have to quarantine them. I mean, and these people, and my problem I have with people is that we understand pain because it occurs in the body, but we don't understand suffering because it occurs in the mind. And serial killers aren't in pain, they're suffering. And they have like mental, serious mental anguish. And they're in, you know, and they're sick. And it's an illness. You know, and if they had bumps and spots all over them, we go, oh, gee, this guy's sick. He needs to be in a hospital someplace. Don't put him in prison because he got sick. You know, he got somebody to get sick. And sometimes when I say this to people, they get really upset. But this, technically, this is what it is. When you find a dead girl or a dead boy in the woods, that is the symptom of a serial killer's illness.
Wow.
Just like a runny nose is a symptom of a cold. Are you following my analogy?
I am, actually. So the last question I have for you, then, is how many of these people are running around our country right now, you think?
Well, for every one that you hear, Quantico suspects that they have, they say they have 200, and for every serial killer that has been brought to trial, they have 250 that they're looking for.
Wow.
And so, and there's probably even more. You know, there's probably even more because now some serial killers want to get caught. They get to that point where they want to get caught. Some serial killers don't.
Yeah, because they want to write books and they want to have blogs and all of that stuff. Dr. Gordon, I appreciate you coming and talking with us. I'd love to talk to you again in the near future because this is fascinating. And I apologize for the ex-producer's mix-up.
Well, you know, if this is the worst thing that happens to you in your life, you're pretty much set.
It is.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Dr. Gordon.
Okay, thank you so much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Great talking with you. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-0-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
Controversial, thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no. They're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Keeping the Chambers of Commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Interesting conversation with Dr. Gordon there. It's one of those things that was thrown at me. He said, hey, what do you think about talking about serial killers? I'm like, okay, why not? Maybe there's a worker angle in there somewhere. But interesting, I really thought he was going to go into, wow, we do these studies and we can now predict. I'm glad he didn't, because it's one of those things that scares the living daylights out of me. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. I got Jake on line two. Jake, how are you doing tonight, man?
I'm doing pretty good, Rick. I just thought I'd make a comment about, and I'm not here to push one candidate for governor, but there's a governor has pushed kind of like a proposal on minimum wage. But before I get into that, I want to take this opportunity to kind of mention this is a kind of an important day when you're talking about health care. Theoretically, this is the deadline to sign up.
Theoretically?
I don't know if you know the numbers, Rick, but I heard earlier tonight that there were actually 3 million visits today, which is amazing, to the national website, 1 million phone calls. To me, that's, wow. There seems to be just pent-up demand for health care, and they have, I think, done a good job in recovering from what was a disaster initially. I think as more and more people understood that maybe it's not as difficult as the Republicans would have you believe to sign up. I think that that demand has kind of reached a pinnacle today. Actually, there's a report by RAND Corporation, believe it or not, Rick, in an L.A. newspaper today. They claim, and they must have some information, apparently the Obama administration doesn't, that 9.5 million are now uninsured now have insurance under health care reform, which is amazing. By the way, today, depending on the circumstance, is not the drop dead date. If you can prove to them that you made a concerted effort to get in the not too distant past, they more than likely will allow you to sign up. And then you talk when you're talking about Medicaid expansion, of course, there is no drop dead date. So the numbers that they came out with are really just kind of like the beginning of the numbers. And I think by and large, considering the disaster of the setup, I think those are pretty good numbers, Rick.
Yeah, is that why everyone's saying, well, you know, they're cooking the books?
Yeah, I saw that Senator Barrasso was on there. There is a reason, Rick, why nobody knows this guy's name. He doesn't say a lot of things that are really earth-shattering. I mean, he's one of the doctor knows, you know, no, 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 no. And the truth is that the Republicans so far, no matter how successful this has been, they're going to say, well, it's irrelevant. In fact, he did say it's irrelevant, which I think is just inexcusable. There are millions of Americans who are going to have health care that didn't have it before. And it's a safe bet to say, Rick, that of those millions that now have it, there's probably a good number that you saved their lives, you know?
Yeah, so, but why would we want to do that?
Well, because it's the right thing to do.
Oh,
and by the way, another corollary issue, since I'm on a roll here. There was a report that recently came out. I was astounded at this. Report that came out that said 34% of American families have a member of the family that is job locked because of health care. Now, that means that individual has to stay on their job because they need that health care.
As they should.
Prevent them from using their God-given abilities. Prevent them from maybe going on and contributing substantially to the success of society, maybe as a scientist or a doctor. Prevent them from using their educational abilities, and many of them, because of the fact that they have children, they don't want to chance it, and they can't chance it because they're putting their children's welfare online, or it's a combination of their children and the fact that they're buying a home. And if you remember, that issue of losing your home was a major issue when they discussed, you know, that whole issue of health care back in 06, 07, and 08. And to some degree, it's still there. To me, that's an amazing, amazing thing. We're the only Western industrialized nation that doesn't have portability. Shame on us.
Yeah.
And I don't think the Democrats or the advocates really speak about that enough. But in fact, it is a major issue. Now, to get the minimum wage, I'm not going to mention that candidate's name, but the one proposal that's kind of in front is to take it to $10.70 initially, right off the bat. That's higher than any other proposal. I believe some of the proposals in the state legislature, 10-10, would be the highest that it would go. When you talk about minimum wage, I think a lot of people really either don't think about it or underestimate the impact of the minimum wage on society. I mean, the truth is, disgracefully, Rick, poverty has been increasing in America in the last 10 years, and one of the major reasons is an inadequate minimum wage, along with failed trade policies. You're talking CAFTA, NAFTA, individual trade agreements, and of course, it was a mistake, obviously, to allow China in the WTO. And that, along with over $2 trillion given to the very wealthy, which basically is largesse with very little in return, we found poverty ever increasing.
And so you're in favor of raising the minimum wage, then, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So what?
But there's an even more when you talk about families and you talk about single parent, Rick, as you know, out of sheer necessity, some of these single parents have to hold sometimes two and even three jobs down. What does that mean? That has a direct impact on the quality of life for their kids. They can't spend quality time for them. They can't, you know, protect them from some of the bad things that can happen to kids with, without proper supervision. There's a whole lot of ramifications that the average person doesn't understand. And even if they could get 1070, and of course the truth is that's not a given, especially, looking at the nomenclature of the legislature in Pennsylvania right now. I mean, it does start the discussion, and at some point, you know, that throwing out 1070 out there will raise the minimum wage to what amount it will be raised remains to be seen. But I think it's important that we talk about that issue because it has a huge influence on millions of people in this country, Rick, and I think it's an important issue.
All right, good. So on the governor's race, who on the Democratic side, who are you in the bag for at this point?
Who do I think will win?
Right. Who's your guy? It's like a horse race. Who's your horse?
Well, Rob McCord.
All right, there you go.
I think at this point, if you're asking me, I think there's two candidates out in front. The one candidate, I saw more commercials for him tonight, Tom Wolf. He's spending an awful lot of money. I think the truth is that he's out in front. And it is a horse race. Can the other candidates catch him? That remains to be seen.
Yeah, we'll see. But at the end of the day, you got a governor who's sitting in the governor's mansion 9 consecutive months as the most vulnerable governor in the midterm elections. 9 months in a row across the country, our guy's the most vulnerable because he's done a horrible job.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I saw a recent poll. I mean, you talk about vulnerable. A recent statewide poll, Republicans, over 30% were undecided as to who they wanted to support. And this is in a primary for an incumbent governor.
Yeah.
Wow.
Corbett or nobody.
And of course, his commercials, Rick, I don't know if you've seen them. I don't know quite where he got those job numbers. My guess would be he just bent down and picked
a winner.
Whatever part of his body he chose. But those numbers, wow, I don't know where he gets those. I mean, the truth is in 3 years since he's been in office, we've gone from, what is it, 4th to 47th? I mean, that's horrible.
7th to 48th, but you've got the right idea. It is what it is. Jake, I appreciate the call, man.
You know, it depends who you listen to. Yeah. It fluctuates.
Yeah, it fluctuates.
Let's just say it's pretty bad.
Either way, it's the wrong direction. Appreciate it, man.
Absolutely.
Call back anytime.
All right, thanks.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class. Rick Smith.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
There are a lot of folks named Bill Jones, but likely only one kept classified photographs secret for more than 40 years. Bill Jones of Stark County, Indiana, was a military photographer. And though he gained some fame from it, it was not what he wanted to do. Jones had a passion for airplanes and wanted to fly them. He took pilot training at Bear Field in 1944, but his rheumatic fever as a child kept his weight too low to ever become an Air Force pilot. Still, Jones's desire to fly is what led him to his moment in history. He went on to spend 6 months in aerial photography in B-17 aircraft, and that was the beginning of a trail that would take him and his cameras to some of the most fascinating scenes in the world's history. Join us again next time for Jones's most famous photographs. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Jess Levin. On Fox News' Fox and Friends Sunday, co-host Anna Koyman and Independent Women's Forum Executive Director Sabrina Schaefer pushed several debunked minimum wage myths on the air.
The majority of minimum wage earners are working part-time. The majority are younger workers, 16 to 24, about 50% are. So it's not quite this dire situation where you have the head of households who are not able to care for their families. And there are, you know, when the price of something goes up, people tend to buy less.
So you're saying it's continuing this phony war on women?
Yeah, of course.
In fact, women make up the majority of minimum wage earners and would benefit much more from an increased minimum wage. According to research from the Center for American Progress, women make up 48.3% of the total workforce, yet two-thirds of minimum wage earners are women. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. My daughter sent me an email off my wife's account, of course, because she's 11, doesn't have her own email. Showed me a picture of a guy with a tattoo on his forearm of a McDonald's receipt. There's something wrong with society when a 20-year-old man would put a receipt on his arm in tattoo form, and an 11-year-old goes, "Boy, that's dumb, Dad. What idiot would do something like this?" Well, we've got a bunch of them. Anyway, let's find out what's going on around the world and in Washington, D.C. I've got Ellen Rettner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
So would you tattoo a receipt of the cheeseburger you got at McDonald's on your arm? Can you imagine how stupid that is?
Well, I'm very against tattoos to begin with, but that's really stupid.
Now, I mean, I can't decide what color socks I'm going to wear tomorrow, and I've only got white and black. I can't imagine something that permanent going, yeah, that's a good idea.
And it's painful. Tattoos are painful.
And I don't think I've ever been that drunk. In the 10 stages of drunkenness, I think once or twice I've been near bulletproof, just not tattoo something stupid on my arm.
Say the least. That is dumb.
Yeah. So what's going on today? I understand the president's been cooking the books.
That is certainly a claim that some Republicans are making about the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare. You and I know that that is not true. Jay Carney from the podium today at the White House said it was not true, but the Republicans are certainly saying that. And in fact, Tom Coburn, who is known as Dr. No and who is retiring, he's actually a physician, said the same thing about the doctor of fix, that this was ridiculous. It was basically cookbooking by the Obama administration and the Democrats, and so they're just throwing out poison darts.
My thought of it first was, if you're going to cook the books, how about cooking the idea that the website wasn't broken? I would have cooked that long before this.
Well, yes. And the fact is that people are signing up for it. It's obviously going to be successful. The Republicans have come up with no other plans, despite the fact that they're throwing arrows. Where's their bill?
They have a plan, Ellen. Pay or die. That's their plan. That's simple. If you have the money or you don't, you pay or you die. Pretty simple. I think they have said that time and time and time again. I think they're very clear on if you can't afford to put food on your table, starve to death. Who is that? The congressman from South Carolina who said, "Mama told me you don't feed the dogs because then all they do is reproduce." So you just let them starve to death is the moral of that story. And look, they've been very clear about their position.
They have been very clear about their position, but... And they think that their position is going to win them elections in November, and I'm not so sure.
No, I'm not sure either, especially in what I think they're really afraid of is that, and I've been saying this for a couple of years now, what they really fear is that eventually people get it. Eventually people sign up for it. People like my grandmother with Medicare, once they get it in their hands and any bugs get worked out, people are actually going to like it, whatever it turns into down the road. And then... like senior citizens, you're going to have to beat them over the head to get it away from them.
That's what I think. And I think that no matter what the Republicans have tried to do, they've tried to
say this isn't going to work. They haven't come up with a plan. People are signing up for it.
I actually know several people who have signed up for it. And, you know, at this point, they're like, well, we're going to see. I know two people who, for the first time in their life, now have health coverage that have never had it before. To me, that's huge.
Pretty impressive.
That is huge.
Absolutely.
And those aren't the stories that we hear. I mean, when I heard the Americans for Prosperity twit on with Chris Hayes not too long ago, I don't even know why you would feed the trolls. Leave the trolls alone. Leave her alone. But, you know, saying, wow, there's 7 million people who didn't want it. Why should the president is making parents, taking parents' choices to not cover their children from them?
It's almost as if, you know, like these religious people that won't get their kids' health care.
Yeah, it's nuts. One of the things I did see that I liked, I actually saw a bumper sticker, and I had to look twice because it said it's a ripoff of the T-Twit thing. Don't tread on me. It said, don't tread on my Obamacare. I thought it had a doctor's stethoscope, looked kind of like the snake there. I thought it was brilliant.
Right. Oh, that is brilliant.
Thought it was brilliant. So no cooking the books then. So that's good. Good to hear. The doc fix and the mental health issues, what happened this evening?
Well, basically, the doc fix did pass. I think it was either 64, 65, but it did pass the Senate. So it's going to happen. Dr. Colburn said that this is just a joke, that there is no such thing, et cetera, et cetera. But it did pass, and it goes for one more year. And the mental health part about this is access to mental health care, which I believe is part of that bill. Debbie Stabenow from Michigan has been very, very active with that and trying to get people so that there's certainly been bills about parity, but people have access to mental health care. So that is opening up, not quite the degree that you and I probably wanted, but a lot more than it's been.
What, you don't want people homeless walking around in the streets talking to themselves? You know, when I did my Hungry and Homeless for the Holiday food drives, you know, for a couple of years, the homeless people that I thought I would be meeting would be drug addicts and alcoholics, you know, the stereotypical homeless person. Most of them were people who at one point were functional human beings who just couldn't get their medicine anymore and weren't, no one was watching them to take it. And, gee, simultaneously, we had closed down the state mental health hospitals and sent those people packing to the streets.
Well, that's right. You know, in my previous life, I ran a psychiatric day treatment center for it was actually the largest psychiatric day treatment center in Massachusetts and actually New England. And we had people from the hospitals that really had not the services that they needed in the street. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, we had one guy that, you know, nobody was there to supervise him taking his meds. He wound up sleeping in a Goodwill box.
Yeah. No, I mean, I met a number of people who, you know, they were functional human beings until there was nobody to make sure that they took their medicine. And it's amazing to me because I've been fortunate that I've never been in that position. But, it seems so simple just to take a pill every day. But you're talking about people who there's something that's not connecting up there. And if just to make sure that someone takes that to keep them functional, that just seems the minimum we should be doing.
For sure. And it's not happening. And the problem is that money has gone away from the Community Mental Health Centers Act, and so it needs to go back in, and that's what Debbie Stabenow's been trying to do.
Yeah, I don't know, but I still think the tax cuts for the Koch brothers and Warren Buffett and Bill Gates to destroy education, I still think those tax cuts are so vitally important. All those people, they'll find their way on the streets, right?
Well, yes, and you know and I know exactly what's going to happen. It is what is happening.
Sad stuff. Also, I understand that there's some information out on the enhanced interrogation techniques, the torture. Did we find bin Laden by torture?
Well, of course, this report has not been fully released by the Senate, but we do know that they're finding that the enhanced techniques, i.e. torture, has not worked. And probably won't work, and certainly did not help us find bin Laden.
Enhanced. I like that. That is so nice and soft. It's so American, enhanced interrogation techniques.
A.K.A. torture.
I mean, it just sounds, it's, well, how bad could it be? It's enhanced. It's wonderful. It's good. It just sounds so nice, doesn't it? Who could be against that? Torture sounds so medieval.
Right. Even though that's what we engaged in.
You know, I remember the guy from Chicago. I forget what the radio guy's name was. Mankow, I think his name was. Where they,
yes.
they put him down on the board for like 10 seconds. He's like, hey, it's torture. Stop, stop. It's torture. Because if you do those things, you know, I'll tell you what. I'll tell you, I killed Kennedy. I wasn't even born yet. You start dropping water down my nose. Sad
right.
stuff. So what's going on in South Korea? I understand there's
okay,
some
Okay, so
some
basically
volume.
What happened is annually there is this sort of mine is bigger than yours.
Yeah.
And North Korea doesn't like the military exercises that South Korea does, often with the help of the good old USA. And so they start shooting some rockets. And then the South replies, and they sent 300 today into the sea. And that is really what's going on. But the South is saying, look, North, you can waste all the military power you want. We've got countries behind us, i.e. the United States. And so that's what happened today, unfortunately. But, you know, the problem with doing this, mine is bigger than yours, is that at some point one of these rockets is going to hit somebody it shouldn't hit.
Yeah. Yeah, but you look at this, and it's just, I saw that the Twitters were all lit up with pictures and all of that, and I'm going, you know, what do you do with a country like North Korea? I mean, what do you do with a guy like Un, who's going to feed his uncle to the dogs?
Well, you know something? I have never in my life met anybody from North Korea. Now, my friend Blanquita has, because she worked with Voice of America and saw some people who had escaped. And there I am eating in China, and the woman who was our waitress, was on a one-year contract from North Korea into Beijing. Quite astounding.
Yeah, and what did she have to say?
Well, I mean, she didn't really say anything. You couldn't really ask her anything. She clearly did not want to be asked anything.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that China's importing labor from North Korea.
Well, you know, it's always that search for the cheapest labor, right? The most exploitable.
I guess so. Isn't that unbelievable?
Not really. I mean, you look at Vietnam's going to be the next, and then eventually Africa's going to be the next cheap labor site if they can control some of the uprising and all of that.
Africa's a mess, trust me.
Yeah, I know, but the Chinese are pouring billions of dollars in there to try and build infrastructure, or at least from the reports that I'm reading.
Well, yes, and I can tell you that there's not one ophthalmologist in South Sudan except at the Chinese eye hospital that they donated.
Yeah.
And that's how they, you know, and we have, unfortunately, we've cut out or tried to cut out a lot of foreign aid, despite the fact that, frankly, foreign aid helps America.
Yeah, you can't explain that to the T-Twits, though, and that brings me to the climate change report today. You know, as I was reading through it, they're saying, you know, they're going to be hundreds of billions of dollars in aid needed to the developing world and poorer countries that are going to really be slammed by climate change. And, well, they are being slammed now, but really in the coming years. And I was thinking about it. Are we going to pay? Or are we going to have a flood of climate change refugees coming to the U.S.?
Well, you're right. One way or the other, we're going to wind up paying, so why not try and deal with climate change now?
No, I want my gas guzzler, Ellen! I want my gas guzzler! I want my Hummer!
That's what's going to happen. And you know it, and I know it. It's really sad.
You know, and one of the quotes that I saw, one of the scientists said, you know, with all the information that's out there, there can't possibly be anyone left who denies this. And I go, really? Have you looked at Congress lately? Have you looked at the Republican platforms lately?
Right. Exactly. Deniers.
Yeah, I mean, it's mind-blowing to me. And, you know,
and they took a look. I mean, this, as you know, since you read the executive summary, which goes on for 50, 60 pages. But, you know, they looked at every possible study. And look what they found.
Yeah, I mean, they found what people have been saying for years, and our Congress is, well, the Republicans mostly, have been done denying the whole time.
Right, and that denial is going to, as you say, at the very least, it's going to turn into a refugee problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, at the end of the day, if I can't feed my kids, and I see somewhere where I might be able to, come hell or high water, I'm going to try. If I don't make it, I'm going to die trying. That's why I don't blame any of the people who come from Central and South America into the U.S., because, you know, you look what our trade policies have done to them. Not going there. And finally, did you find it interesting that Governor Christie, with the Bridgegate scandal, used the exact same law firm that Richard Nixon used 62 years ago in his to clear him of wrongdoing?
Well, there are white criminal law firms around New York. And they are used by people, for sure.
Yeah. Well, it's just odd that this is the exact same one comes 62 years later.
I didn't catch that, but that's an interesting catch.
Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher, the same one that evidently, as I watched the videotape of the speech Nixon gave 62 years ago, that he did not take $18,000 for his personal use, and this firm went and did exhaustive research for him to say that he didn't. And it's the same group that did exhaustive research of Chris Christie with taxpayer money.
I think Chris Christie is not going to be the nominee.
No, he did get the Sheldon nod, right?
Yes, but I'm telling you, I just, you know, they're looking at Jeb Bush.
Of course they are. He seems more reasonable.
It's quite amazing.
It is amazing. Another Bush. That's just what we need. Isn't there anyone else? Isn't there another family in this country? Isn't there another oligarch we could choose from? I don't care at this point, anybody but a Bush.
Well, you might get a Clinton.
Well, either way.
Exactly.
Ellen, it's great talking with you.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Yeah. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
For and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
There isn't anyone immune from globalization. In fact, the confluence of greed and geography blends seamlessly over all of humanity. As the American workforce has become more sophisticated and smart, corporations have become less agreeable. Of course, there were numerous road signs that led to globalization, and at this point, somewhat improbable that any single cause could be raised from the economic wreckage it has created. However, 1976 may have been a high watermark for the American economy, where a change in the tax code emboldened corporations to move more operations overseas. Where these gutless entrepreneurs once shuttered factories in the Northeast and moved them to southern localities, they were now served up by the U.S. Congress, a world plate, where even to their insatiable greed, the possibilities seem limitless. The assault on American workers continued in the next.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. When you get down to the top of the throne, not talking just at the Rick. What can't let my friend? You can't kill the process. Can't kill. You can't kill the process. You can't murder the rebel. Murder. You can't murder the rebellion.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Gotta love when the commercial goes, it just stops. It's happened to me like three times in the last couple of weeks. I think I need to take a hammer to the automation system. We'll fix it. I can fix it. I have a hammer. At least that's what I tell my wife. I can fix anything with a hammer and duct tape and, you know, some spackle and a whole bunch of other stuff to cover up. Just is what it is. Anyway, welcome back to the program. Interesting story today. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration just issued a new job-killing regulation. Evidently, they're going to require that all vehicles, trucks, buses, you know, all that stuff, under 10,000 pounds have rear view cameras. And I had asked earlier on Facebook, you know, what people thought of it. And you can weigh in on our Facebook page as well, facebook.com/Rick Smith, or facebook.com/The Rick Smith Show. And some people threw out some good ideas. I mean, the one guy said, look, you know, at the end of the day, if it's going to save us from backing over one child, not a bad idea. And, you know, I had thought about this. Because I'm thinking, well, here we go. Is this something necessary? You know, I've never backed into anything. And you know, my wife's got a camera on her car that I never use. In fact, it's annoying as all can be because when you put the bike rack on the back of it, all it does is make a ton of noise. So, you know, it's one of those things. Do I really need it? And, you know, as some of the comments came in saying, hey, well, you know, maybe if it saves one child being backed over, maybe it's not a bad idea. And, you know, I always think about, you know, there was a policeman that I met in the area that, you know, years ago, you know, and it's one of these horrible tragedies that somehow his infant daughter had crawled into the garage and behind the car. And I guess somebody, I don't know who it was, I think it was his wife, began backing out of the car and actually backed over the child, and now she's paralyzed from the waist down. And I remember at the time that we were doing some fundraising around getting for service dogs and stuff like that. And I remember going, you know, how do you wake up in the morning, you know, after something like that? You know, I've got three kids, and I can't imagine what it would be like to have to look them in the eye knowing, you know, I did this. And as my wife pointed out, well, you know, you'd have to figure it out real quick because now you've got a child that's even more dependent on you. And while I don't think that a rear camera would have stopped that situation, I don't know, I can't say. The idea that maybe there's a way of going, well, you know, maybe it can cut down on the number of those type of accidents, maybe not a bad thing. Now, the other part of this, as I was thinking, is going, you know, is this going to be another one of those things that, you're struggling to, you know, keep a roof over your head, and you're struggling to do this and that, and it's one more thing come inspection time that now is going to have to be fixed? Yeah, I don't know. And it's, you know, we'll see how it weighs out. As I understand, as the story laid out, the idea of implementation is along the lines of, it's going to be a couple of year rollout where, I guess next year, they're going to have to be like 10% of the cars have these. The year after, it's an increase of more than that. And, you know, until eventually, I guess, in the third year, in 2018, it's the end of it. Every car, every truck, every vehicle will have this. And, you know, I don't know. It's one of those things that, you know, if it does stop that one tragedy, well, maybe it's worth it. I'm on that. Yeah. But cars built, you know, in after May 1st of 2015, 10% of the vehicles, 40% a year later, and then 100% in May of 2018, to be exact, as I pointed out, which I think, you know, we'll see. We'll see. I know the right wing, job killers! Actually, job creator, to be honest, because you're going to have to make more cameras. So I should have bought stock in the camera companies yesterday. Anyway, tomorrow night, Pat LaMarche is going to sit in for me. This week's going to be a little funky as we're preparing for the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO convention next week, which we'll be broadcasting from all next week. Because, you know, I think when you're talking about worker issues, you're talking about worker stories, you want to be where that is. So we're going to be in Pittsburgh next week. So Tuesday and Thursday, Pat LaMarche is going to sit in while I prepare to get all that done. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath. Put a sway, imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray.
democracy is coming.